Ladies and gentlemen, grab your drinks and popcorn. Today's feature is about to begin. Welcome to Celluloid Codswallop.
Hello, welcome to this week's Celluloid Codswallop, and it's been a very long time since I've actually done a Celluloid Codswallop, and I'm not flying solo on this one, but I'm not flying with Gemma either. I have been lucky enough to get hold of, well, the newest member of the team, and despite what people will think, or the Salty Tadpoles will think, he does actually have a face, unlike the strange image that Gemma put together, bless her, but you know, she did far better than I ever could in creating the art. But I've waffled on enough to confuse you and make you wonder what on earth is going on. I'm joined by the one and only, the wonderful, the fourth member of our, well, we were once a trio, we're now a wonderful quintet, whatever the term I'm looking for is, Mr. James Higson. James, how are you doing?
I'm great.
And I bet you're thinking, after such a long-winded introduction, what can you say apart from you're great? And I agree, that's a wonderful response.
Yeah. I'm here. I'm doing great. You made me watch *License to Kill*.
Well, there are fates. There are fates far worse than that.
Absolutely. You could have made me watch a George Lazenby.
Well, in case you haven't guessed, we are going to be discussing *License to Kill* for this episode of Celluloid Codswallop. And for those who have listened to the previous podcasts I've done, you will know I am a huge James Bond fan, which is a wonderful thing that James and I have in common. We both enjoy the films. Now, for those who've listened previously, I have been looking at the interview.
I have to interrupt.
Oh, go on.
Not just the films. Even.
That's true.
Have you know, I have read the entire collection since I was gifted it as a teenager, so I love the books as well. So I've read all the Ian Fleming novels as well as the films. So I am a true 007 fan in that sense.
I stand corrected. He is probably as much as, maybe even more of a fan than I am. I mean, it's going on side tangent. It was a very interesting point you made that you actually have read the books, because I remember talking to AJ Chowdhury, who wrote the wonderful... a wonderful book about James Bond, Some Kind of Hero. And he was saying, asking me the question, he said, have you read any of this stuff other than my work? And he seemed quite impressed by the fact that I've pretty much read all the books I could get my hands on. So it's nice to find there's somebody else who's done that. For those who have listened to the podcast, you will be lucky enough to know that I have interviewed people who've been involved with the Bond series, namely Timothy Dalton's work. And for those who obviously know me on Bond, Timothy Dalton is my favourite Bond. Unfortunately, we only have two of his films to go on, but we are discussing his second entry into the series, which is *License to Kill*. And for all you Americans out there, it's spelled with two C's, not a C and an S. It's not my all-time favourite Bond film. I'm kind of putting that out there straight away. My all-time favourite Bond film is *The Living Daylights*, but this was the toss-up idea that James and I had. I can't remember, James, was this your choice to discuss this one, or was it one that I kind of went with?
I think it was a joint choice, because obviously we had a situation where we weren't quite sure what to do, because we needed to fill in with a podcast. So I suggested something that we both would not really need a huge reminder about. Mm-hmm. So I said, well, why don't we pick a Bond film? And then you said *License to Kill* or *The Living Daylights*, which took me a while to work out, because you told me in initials. So I'm like, what the hell is LTK? And I'm pretty sure we don't have *The Dark Knight Lives* as a Bond film. And then it struck me as to which ones we were talking about. So
*License to Kill* is an interesting entry into the series, because it was at the time quite a departure of a style of film. But to just give the sort of the Tadpoles an idea, a bit of history on it. So it was the second Bond film that was made by Timothy Dalton. It was a 1989 entry into the series.
It's as old as I am.
Well, it's younger than I am. But it's the first Bond film that had a 15 rating. And it was quite a departure, wasn't it, for the series? Because it went into a violent manner with its story. I mean, all Bond films have a level of violence, but this was taken to a point that was markedly different than anything we'd had before.
Absolutely. I tend to find that with License to Kill, especially if you do watch it in sequence, so you know you're just off the living daylights, you tend to find that the murders and the deaths scenes seem to be more personal. And one thing I did notice is it's a huge departure from the Bond formula, in that for once, this is just for James.
Mm-hmm.
This is not for the safety of the world. This is just James is angry and wants revenge.
Mm-hmm.
And rightly so. You know, we'll get into the plot later, but as I have to say, it's very divisive in that it treads new ground. So like all new, you know, all films that decide to shift their position slightly, you're going to like it or you're going to hate it. Now, I like it from a story writing point of view. I like the fact that they tried something different with the same characters. And I did like how they actually worked around things and, you know, tried to keep a Bond film. But I also like that they tried something different. Again, it's not my favourite. I mean, mine is actually the follow-up, which is GoldenEye. GoldenEye is my Bond film. But it's an entertaining watch. And again, I'd say it feels more like Book Bond. I don't know about you, James.
Mm. I mean, it's interesting, just going on a side note, when you mentioned GoldenEye. GoldenEye is actually the first Bond film I ever got to see in a cinema. So it was that was quite a special one for me. And it's the one that I probably had the most real knowledge of as I was getting, you know, as I became more aware of Bond films.
Mm.
I got to experience the whole process of the Bond film coming out, because I'd obviously been too young for the other films, certainly Dalton's and most definitely Moore's and wasn't even alive for some of the ones before. But it definitely has that feel of the Bond of the novel, which is certainly one of the main things they say about Dalton. He is sort of Fleming's Bond. You can imagine he's walked off the page. And it also takes, every Bond film to a degree takes something from the novel that it was either based on, or it takes something from them. And in this case, it took from Live and Let Die for elements of the plot, and from the Hildebrand rarity as well.
Yes.
The plot. It might even go into Property of a Lady with a part of it, but you certainly lifted from those two. But we're getting ahead of ourselves for those who are listening. So to give an idea of the plot, this sees Bond pretty much just being Bond. He's not, as you said, he's not on any kind of mission for this. It opens seeing him with his friend Felix Leiter attending his wedding.
And Sharky. Don't forget Sharky.
And Sharky, yeah, don't forget Sharky. But the other interesting thing is that up until this point, it was the only time we saw an actor playing Leiter returning to the role, which was David Hedison, who'd first played the part in Live and Let Die with Roger Moore. And obviously, you'd look at it and think, well, you know, there's an age discrepancy between him and Bond, but there's always an age discrepancy of some sort with the characters. This, I think, happened because it adds to what happens within the story, that it's a recognized face, that it's someone you can go, aha, this is somebody who we actually can link, rather than having the previous people who's always changing every single time.
Now, you could argue as well, it could also be the fact that obviously the agent element is, that's why the recast, there is no Felix Leiter. Felix Leiter is a pseudonym, it is a code name, again, much like the idea floated for Bond himself until Skyfall, was there's no such person as James Bond, that's why his face changes all the time. It's just a name. So, but it was nice to have that continuity, because especially when it comes down to Q and Moneypenny, for example, you know, those are two very regular occurring characters. So it's nice to add someone outside of MI6 as a returning character. But yeah, I love the opening, with it being obviously everyone's kitting up for Felix's wedding. So James Bond in a three-piece suit with tails.
which looks like it, which on if you look at the Suits of James Bond website where the Matt Spazer runs, he makes the comment that it's obviously clearly a rental.
Yes, yes.
It's not the most elegant.
I would love to see the conversation afterwards. Excuse me, sir, why does this smell of gunpowder? Don't ask.
Why is there a hole in your hat?
I did think that was hilarious, how it was just the opening scene is obviously Felix, Sharky and Bond in the wedding car being stopped on the freeway by the US Coast Guard via helicopter.
Mm-hmm. And linked to the DEA.
Yeah. Because it's like we have all the government agencies involved. We have the CIA with Felix, the DEA, and the Coast Guard, which again makes sense because again the main villain of this is a drug runner, mm-hmm. who is played fantastically by, is it Robert Davi? Yes, Robert Davi. Yeah. He is absolutely fantastic. He is a absolutely fantastic character actor. I loved him in this. I loved him in The Goonies, and I loved him in Stargate Atlantis, which is another sci-fi reference, which is always
fun. The interesting thing you hit upon with this, actually, when you mentioned the other agencies in it, it's right at the start of the film. You have a mention of the fact that the tracking. Well, to give a bit more history to the story, so where this film really kind of became different, and you hit on it really early on, then previous Bonds, is it isn't some maniac trying to take over the world. It's not some guy with trying to, you know, control Silicon Valley like in,
say, there's no Blofeld. There's no Live and Let Die,
No Mr. Big sort of thing. You know,
yeah, there's there's no Blofeld. There's no there's just no big baddie who just wants the world. This is just literally one Cuban who's got a mini sub operation, essentially.
Hmm. Because
it's all set in like the Florida Keys and that surrounding area. It's such a microcosm as well. It's another step away that is unique to any of the other Bond films, in that technically Bond doesn't even return to the UK at any point.
That's which true. Again, I mean, it's very true, and it's a level of realism to it, I guess, because it's a drug runner, it's a drug dealer. So when the film opens, you've got you see the situation of where it kind of ties into the fact that you're saying about all these agencies. Robert Davi's character, Fran Sanchez, has obviously his girlfriend, Lupi, played by Talisa Soto, has cheated on him.
Mm.
I can say from a standpoint, that's not a smart move in any shape or form, because he goes with his gang, gets the boyfriend, makes the comment of, you know, what did he promise you, his heart? You know, basically give her his heart, and his guys go out to take the guy's heart out.
Fun fact as well. Is lead henchman a very, very young Benicio del Toro?
Ah, very true. Yeah, I'd forgotten that.
Even in his young baby faced years, he's just as menacing as he is now. I got such Sicario vibes from him. Mm. Like he's perfect for that kind of role, where it's soft spoken but absolutely terrifying. And a genuine threat, despite youth, and you know, you wouldn't think it. He does it brilliantly.
And where you see this kind of level, something you didn't see in the Bond films before, and this is within that opening scene, is that level of violence. You know, this guy has his heart cut out. You know, Sanchez whips his girlfriend with a stingray's tail whip sort of thing he's got, and it's quite a brutal thing. You would not have seen that.
No,
Go on, sorry.
No, I was just going to say as well, it's the fact that he brings it with him. It's not like it's not like he takes off his belt or he picks up the nearest object to strike her. It's the fact that he appears to, this is a regular occurrence, and it turns out it is. It turns out Lupe's character often runs away, and he just tracks her down, and her punishment is to take the lashings.
Mm.
And it is the fact that it's a close up on Lupe's face, on Sanchez's face, but it feels so much more visceral in that it's just the two of them in the room, and she barely makes a noise, which again is laying that groundwork of Sanchez. This is atypical behavior for him.
I mean, you're right on because he even says to her not a word before he starts hitting her. But here's one for you. Let's see if we can test your knowledge on Bond. So you mentioned the fact that all these agencies are involved. When they're tracking his plane, knowing it's going to the Keys, and whose voice do we hear for extra points? Even though there are no points, because, you know, what do points mean? Well, in this case, bugger all, but I like to test.
Points mean prizes.
Yeah.
I feel like it's on the tip of my tongue, but I'm stumbling over it.
It's all right. I'll end the punishment. So, you know, we might just nab the bastard. The King of Cameos, it's Michael G. Wilson's voice.
Ah. Because I believe he's uncredited as well.
It's quite possible he's uncredited, but I definitely know it was him who did the cameo. But as you said, so moving along, so they're tracking him. They find him. They go by helicopter, you know. Well, Bond, the DEA, and Leiter. They leave poor old Sharky to basically carry the cannon and explain why to not be at his wedding.
That'll go Sharky down has well. To explain to a bride. Yes, sorry. We got kidnapped by the Coast Guard. Well, I say we, them two. And Bond is along as an observer. I like, again, just the idea of, here's a sidearm, which, again, it's very strange seeing Bond wielding something that isn't a Walther PPK. But, again, it's just being told, no, you're an observer, sit in the helicopter. Because, again, another point that the film likes to point out is, this isn't Bond's core. This isn't Bond's area of expertise, nor is it his permission. Because again, everyone tries to make that clear to Bond. This is nothing to do with you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is not an MI6 job. It just so happens that on the day of my wedding, where you are invited, it's now or never to wrap up this drug deal.
That's true.
So it's nice that it's a case of, you know, Bond is almost on a back seat for this. Yet we still get to see him do some wonderful, wonderful stunts.
It's also interesting to a point that I observed watching the film is that one of the DEA agents is played by Grandel Bush, which links in also with Robert Darby, because they're both in Die Hard together playing CIA agents.
Yes, because Davy was the Vietnam veteran who calls in halfway through and nearly cocked everything up.
Yeah. So what did you make of the pre-title sequence, which is... I'm letting the salty tabbles into a secret. I've seen some of James's notes, so I have looked at them. He made comments upon this, and I had a quick look at them because I had the surprise of knowing what he, you know.
Well, I also didn't. Fresh. I didn't show you the other 5.5 pages I ended up
That's
writing.
That's what I like. So, what did you think of this? Because I'm rather mixed. There's elements of this pre-title sequence I love, but there's a very specific element of it too with planes and fishing.
Yes.
And I'm always a bit unsure what to make of that one.
No, I agreed. I agree with you. Basically, Davy manages to escape in a Cessna, small little two-seater plane. So Bond and Felix jump aboard the US Coast Guard helicopter, and Bond decides to use what I would call the personnel winch to lower himself onto Davy's plane, but rather than take the controls or anything like that, he pulls a Christopher Nolan 20 years early. Because I did know, I got huge Dark Knight vibes. Not Dark Knight. Which one's the third Batman of the Nolanverse?
Dark Knight Rises vibes, definitely there. And you can see, I mean, Nolan is a huge Bond fan. And said that it reflects upon elements of his film. But yeah, as you were saying, it's this moment where, to me, it lacks the urgency and the kind of oomph of some of the pre-title sequences, that Bond is lowered to wrap a cord. As you said, it's like the personnel movement thing around the plane to take the weight of it. And yeah, it's kind of cool, but I don't know.
I don't believe it. Like, it does take me out of it, in the sense of the plane's thin aluminium, and all I can envision is, again, much like in Nolan's film, where the plane disintegrates essentially from the forces, it would do the same. However, again, it's a little jarring to begin with, but it still feels like Bond, because it's no worse than any other opening stunt. You could go through all of the stunts in James Bond and talk about the physical limitations.
Yeah.
Again, speaking of the living daylights, one of my favorites is Bond cutting a larder off at the chassis with the laser hubs and not hacking off two Russian police officers' ankles.
That's true.
Which, again, should have happened, but I think there is that element of I can suspend my disbelief for some things, and when we're talking a big set piece, it's one of those of I still like it. I still think it's a novel way of doing it, but I think a better plan would have been Bond fighting Sanchez and having him pulled out of the plane with the winch, so that he is, again, he's still fishing. So it looks like he's the bait swinging around unconscious underneath, because Bond already has a parachute on. So I would have also worked if it had just been he opens the door, grabs Davy, throws him out, and unbeknownst to us as the audience, he's actually clipped his belt or something. So he's hanging upside down from the winch, and then Bond just bails and lets the plane go. And then Felix jumps out afterwards. Because they both parachute to the wedding, which I think that was I was like, well, that's a stroke of luck, isn't it? Just to be over, and yet no one looks up into the sky and points when there's a helicopter towing a plane, but when two men in rental tuxes come down on parachutes in the middle of town.
Well, it's also, I do find it amusing that Felix's wife, Della, when her father's saying to her, I told you this was a bad idea.
Yeah.
Interest. So obviously they parachute down, they get to the wedding. We get Gladys Knight's theme song, License to Kill, which I didn't mind it. It's grown on me.
Yeah, it's very 80s, very power ballad. But I think when you compare it to like Diamonds Are Forever, it's kind of got that vibe eventually. But I think it is one that grows on you.
It's a change in the whole kind of soundtrack, because it was Michael Kamen who did the soundtrack, and really prior to that, would mainly, other than a few changes, seldom few, generally always been John Barry's kind of bag. So this is quite a departure in the style. And interestingly, originally, for the actual, just the James Bond theme, which is kind of a bit different in this one as well, I believe they got Eric Clapton to play it originally, a version of it, which for many years wasn't even available. You can now find it online on YouTube. Very different style. So yeah, this was a big shift. We pass from that into, obviously, thankfully, Felix's wedding has gone ahead. He's now happily married to Della. Everyone's partying at his house. We get an interesting, Felix is still working. He's off at his office working. And we see our first sign of the Bond girl to be, which is
the lovely one, Pam.
Yes, Pam.
Pam Boucher, I believe it is. Bouvier,
yes. Which Bouvier, leads to an amusing thing later on with the name swap. But it's also, this is like the last film we ever see Bond smoking cigarettes, which is
openly.
Yes. Yeah. Because obviously Dalton himself was a smoker, and he brought back that little handle of Bonds
back from the Connery days, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
Did you also notice the Chekhov's gun moment?
Oh, tell me, go on.
The lighter.
Ah, what, the gift lighter?
The very specific gift lighter, you know, James, love forever from Delia and Felix.
Yes. Yep.
And I'm like, that's going to come into question somewhere now, isn't it?
Well, they also, the sad reality of that is that it has a very, very overactive lighting mechanism. But the problem we now face with things like Blu-ray and 4Ks, you can see the little tube running.
Yes, running down his sleeve that will
fed the extra Dalton's sleeve.
Propane. Yeah. Again, I have to admit, though, speaking of effect-wise and upscaling, it seemed to do quite well.
Yeah, like, oh God,
I noticed that a couple of the special effects still hold up really nicely. And some of it, I do think, is down to the way that they were shot.
Mm-hmm.
There's a death scene, and the way that it was shot really helped with the aging of the effect. But as I say, we'll get on to that afterwards. But yes, we have the lovely after the wedding moments where everyone is getting everyone's having a nice yes, essentially. Then unfortunately, Felix gets found, as it were.
Yeah, because it cuts interestingly that Sanchez is known to be somebody who pays people off to get out of jail. And we, he obviously, you know, saying like, you'll have to remind me of the actor's name who's plays Killifer, but he, I know
Everett
him from,
McGill.
Yeah, Twin Peaks. Wonderful
Twin
guy.
Peaks. He was also, I remember him from one of his, not as great films, if I remember correctly, and I'm just going to double check this because I don't want to look like an idiot, I'm almost certain he was in Under Siege 2. And yes, he was.
<You're right. laughs>
He was the lead henchman to the villain in that. And I just remember there's a very famous scene where Steven Seagal's daughter sprays him in the face with pepper spray, and he just takes it off or opens his mouth and puts it in his mouth and sprays it.
Like, that's a real nightmare.
No different than hot sauce or something like that. But yeah, he was also in the original Dune.
Ah. Dilgar
in Dune. So again, another fantastic character actor who you know him when you see him, but you can never quite remember what from, but the things that he is in, he does leave a good impression.
And Killifer's really seen as being the good, like the real buddy of Felix. But, you know, as one would always say, foreshadowing. Because, again, and you were, the point you made earlier is so spot on. Florida. Florida really is, I mean, you see him going through the Florida Keys, they're going over this big bridge because,
Sanchez being transferred.
Yeah. Yep.
And he's in the back of the van with Killifer, because initially Killifer makes a huge point about that's, you know, this is your money, does your money's no good here. And
yeah, scumbag drug money.
And then and Sanchez is just like, green is green no matter where it is. You know, he's like, and it, you know, 2 million, even in 1989 money, that's a good chunk of change.
He actually doubles it, doesn't he? He offers, he goes, instead of the $1 million bribe, he'll do two.
Yeah. And then obviously we find out mid transfer that he's actually accepted it.
Mm-hmm.
Killiford strikes the other guard with his shotgun, which then forces the van off the bridge into the sea. where, and I'm still trying to, I had to rewatch it a few times, and I'm still not quite sure how that got arranged.
Who knows? I mean, I can only think it's to do with one of the characters we see later on. It's some arrangement with Crest, who's one of Sanchez's people. But
yeah,
that all goes ahead because they're rescued by some mariners and they go off wherever they're going to go to. And there's the point in the film here is I love it, love this scene, because it's a real nod back to Bond as a person, which is where he's leaving and Della and Felix are there, and she's going to throw her garter to him, saying that the next person catches the next one to get married, and he doesn't want it. He's just going, no, I'm going to go. And she ends up throwing it to him anyway, and he catches it, and she's trying to work out what she's done wrong. And Felix is saying, you know, he was married once, but it was a long time ago.
Yeah, and Dalton, I made this in my notes, Dalton nails that quiet emotion of, you can see the pain in his eyes. Mm-hmm. So you immediately know that's exactly what he's thinking. Oh God, you know, my memory's going back to that day my wife was killed, you know, but again, he doesn't let it show through other than his eyes. And I think he does a really good job. But again, unfortunately, this is all in hindsight. Yeah, so I can also understand how this can be so jarring for people when it's just like, why is Timothy Dalton staring at me through a screen? And it's like, no, he's trying to, you know, and I think he does actually do a good job of it.
I mean, I think we're kind of going all over the place, but it is the point you made that, the problem I think Dalton had is I've said this previously, discussing him, that probably I think he's too good for the role. He's too good an actor. And he's giving you what Bond would probably be like as close to reality rather than the action man that people probably maybe expected or wanted at the time.
Well, I noticed again, I know we will get back to the plot, but the quips weren't there. He only makes like two in the entire film.
Yes. Yeah.
All the quips are given to other characters. Mm. They have the funnier lines,
To be fair, I prefer. I don't want Bond being like a walking quip bag.
I don't mind it when he does it to himself. I don't like it when he does it in front of other people.
Yeah, like the Roger Moore school.
that's where I feel Austin Powers nailed that.
Oh God, well, that's the whole thing with Austin Powers. It gets it perfectly, where it's just quip, 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 quip.
And it takes the other actor to go, right, that's enough. And he goes, agreed. It's like, we should get moving, Austin. Righto.
But the film, then, again, and the point that really hits home with this film is it's that tonal shift. So the henchmen are at Felix's house. They cold cock him with a pistol. And then you can see they're going to do unmentionable, horrible things to Della. And then Felix is there. The scene cuts to him. He's coming out of unconsciousness, and he's at a warehouse with Sanchez, with Dario, with a multitude of other people, with Crest there, underwater.
It's nice that it's not very clear as to where they are.
Yes.
Like, there's no obvious signs that this is an aquarium, as it were. Though, you know, that this is something to do with fisheries, until the slab of meat comes out and the floor opens up.
Yeah, and this, if you were watching Bond, if you took yourself back and imagine, you've watched Roger Moore's stuff, you've seen the fantastical things, you know, even looking at Dalton's previous one, it was, you know, a bit of trying to take over the world. Well, even that was getting a bit more realistic, some kind of drug stuff, et cetera, et cetera. But it wasn't like this. Can you imagine watching this without any real knowledge of the cinema and you're going, what the? Oh, my God, what is going to happen now?
Well, I also like the idea of, almost the opposite, like, in the sense of, remember Kananga with being inflated over a pit of crocodiles? Again, absolutely ludicrous, but I liked how they managed to package almost the same elements using a wild animal as a weapon, and made it feel like it was even possible.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that, you know, yes, the floor opened up and we're above a great white shark. Yeah, it's Florida Keys. It's Miami. They have sharks.
Mm-hmm.
It all feels like, I have no doubt everyone who was from Florida watching it was like, "Oh, that's nothing. That's a baby. That's a tiny one." But the fact that, as you say, to anyone else, you'd be like, "Oh my God, he's got a shark."
Yeah, and it's quite a thing to watch because Lighter is there, and he basically, you know, he knows what's going to happen. He's seen it unfold. He sees Killifer, so he knows he's been double-crossed as well.
He's not quite sure because, as I mentioned before, the slab of meat, which looked like half a cow, that you can almost see a slight confusion. Like, why is that there?
Well, surely you're right, because they all.
Surely you wouldn't
want to
feed the shark if you're going to feed it. Me.
Hmm.
So it's almost like Felix is like, this is definitely not going to be a standard situation. This is not going to just be torture and then murder. This is going to be something horrific, and in turn it becomes it, where the meat is used as a counterweight to Felix. So the shark begins feasting on the meat. And as it does, Felix lowers into the water. And the fact that, again, Sanchez, he's probably looking for information, doesn't need it.
Mm.
This is purely to be horrific to Felix.
Well, as he says to him, it's nothing personal, it's just business.
Yeah, but you've got to remember, even from a plot point, his henchmen are still back at Felix's home. And as we discover later through Bond, they've searched the whole house. They took all his files. They take all his files. They take all his documents. So when you learn that, you look back on it and realize, yeah, that's just sadistic. Mm-hmm. It's not like he's going to pull him back out once, because obviously Felix loses a leg, and he almost loses his arm because the shark eats the meat, lowers him in, starts chomping on Felix, and Felix is recovered.
Well, it's quite a graphic scene as well, because you see him being eaten, you know, he sees his lost limbs, and then it cuts to Bond, because Bond's going to undertake his next mission, goes to the airport, and he's trying to figure out what's going on, and he says to the lady at the first class desk, what's going on? She's like, oh, drug dealer escaped. He's like, oh crap.
Yes.
Runs out.
One thing that did upset me about that is all of Bond's flights are usually booked under Commander.
Ah, well, you think he'd be under a fake name, but...
No, because it gives him clearance. Because he's travelling to... it's only a pseudonym if it needs to go into a non-allied territory. But Bond's mission is in Istanbul.
Yes.
Which, at the time, I believe was still allied.
But yeah, you're right, because she might just make it a slip. She missed the thing.
Yeah, I think it's a very, very minor thing, but I do like it when people call him Commander Bond, because it's a reminder of he's not just a spy, he is a serviceman as well.
Yeah, he's
carries a rank in the Navy.
But he obviously hot foots it over to Felix's house, and no response, goes in armed. And this is kind of the beauty of Dalton in the acting. You see real sorrow because he finds the dead body of Della, who's been raped and murdered by the henchman.
You can kind of see as well, they really had to tone it down, because I actually thought she should be in a lot worse state than she should.
Yeah.
So you can clearly tell, like, even when they were making it, they knew they were pushing it. And a lot of the behind the scenes, you know, echoes that sentiment of this was nearly an 18 because of the nature of the way that, you know, the way that they were trying to portray the story of being very realistic. It also meant it was very gruesome.
And it's interesting when he does find Felix, we obviously understand, they assume he's dead on the dumped on the sofa in the office with the, you know,
in a body note. Bag.
Yeah, with this
That's
note.
That's the creepy bit as well. It's the fact that they, obviously, again, as Bond walks in, you see the office has been turned over, papers are all over the place, and there is a body bag on the sofa. And as you say, initially Bond opens it up, sees Felix, finds the note, which again, I get diehard vibes from it. He disagreed with something that ate him.
Well, the interesting thing when he walks in is also you see Bond looking visibly upset. It's not the you know, the unhuman action star. Now the note, the elements of him losing limbs and him being eaten by a shark and the note are all from the novel of Live and Let Die. It's all lifted from that. But yeah, somehow, and Lord only knows how, Felix is alive.
That I was a little surprised at. Given the way that some of the other characters are treated later in the film, I'm very surprised that Felix was the one to survive.
Mm.
But it was, and you see the look on his face when Bond realizes and he, you know, trying to desperately call for an ambulance and things like that and trying to get his head around everything. And you can kind of see him start going off the rails at this point.
Yeah, you know, when he's when he screws the note up, you can see, again, this is what I love about Dalton. You see the, you know, does not put too fine a point on it. He's pissed.
Absolutely.
It's the rage levels he does. It's like that scene in Living Daylights after Saunders is killed. Don't get a very good line in rage.
Mm. And as I said, he does a man reaching the end of his limit. He does that very well in that you can see that twig snap in his mind, like behind his eyes. You can see it's like, oh yeah, here we go. And the chainsaw comment as well, which leads them on.
I always found that a really kind of strange comment when the policeman's like, huh. You can bet it's like some kind of drug thing, chainsaws, with a bit of a quip.
Yeah, I mean, I understand it, and it's a nice little nod to Scarface. The idea of this is what the drug dealing world is like in Florida. You know, chainsaw attacks are apparently, you know, 10 a penny. So. But it's the fact that Sharky, who we later find out through conversation, charters boats for a living. Mm-hmm. Therefore, he knows the Bay Areas. He knows it's a shark bite. That's what leads them on to the initial plan of attack, as it were. So we need to find out where can we find sharks? Where are we likely to be able to find a shark? And they find Crest's aquarium, which interestingly, something that I picked up when I was watching it, but never really played on, was he mentions genetically altered fish.
Yes, he does. About the line about making them fatter. I mean, I like also the fact
they're all changed to male so that they can gain weight faster. And I found that interesting because I thought, again, why mention it if it's not used? Because surely that would draw more attention to your operation, which is technically a cover. So why would you do something so radical, which could then see you thrust into the limelight?
Well, at that time also, the when mentioning cover, Bond's cover is pretty good. He uses the old Universal Export, which is MI6's forever, you know, cover for just about everything. When he goes in, but it's also the little nods that have seen Bond being observant, because he sees the, what would be like the lapel flower, doesn't he, on the floor? That makes him realize that that's where it all went down. Yeah.
He sees the buttonhole, and that is his immediate trigger of, I don't care what they're saying, this is the place. Now we need to find out why it was here, you know, what happened here. Which, you know, cues the first visit during the night. Also, he notices the submarine the mini sub.
Yes.
Which, again, in the plot line, Crest claims that he no longer hunts sharks, and yet the sub is called Shark Hunter 2.
Mm-hmm. Because he tries to make a thing to sell it, doesn't he, to
yeah.
The Bond.
Which I thought was a nice, thinking on his feet. Shows that Crest is definitely involved because he's very quick to come up with a cover. In that, yeah, I don't need you to use it anymore. You want to buy it? Because imagine if Bond had said yes.
Yeah, go on. I'll make you an offer.
Yeah, how much you offer it?
To the roof of the car outside.
But that's what I mean. It could have blown the whole thing out of the water. Because Crest knows he needs it, but it shows that he's trying to think of a cover quickly. So it's nice to know, yeah, our characters are on the right track, obviously. But again, it's that observational thing of it's showing that Bond is picking up on the details. And as you say, he finds the corsage on the floor, finds the buttonhole, sorry. So he immediately knows, I need to look into this further. And then obviously we begin the night raid, which is does have one of the weaker special effects in it.
The shark head.
The rubber shark head, yes.
Yeah.
Very, very much reminds me of Bruce from Jaws.
It's Bruce's smaller, weaker cousin.
Little Bruce. Yeah, it's I don't know whether it's played for laughs or whether it is meant to be a jump scare, but Bond steps on a grate as they're infiltrating this aquarium and they're going in from the water rather than from the pavement side. So as he steps on this grate, a shark head just lifts him up.
Mm.
And it terrifies Sharky. That's it. It just swims off.
So like, yeah, okay. Yeah, it is. I mean, the action scenes when it cuts to inside the actual, you know, building, I always thought it's pretty good. You know, you see Bond having to take out the security guys who are in there, and he flicks one he's initially trying to find what's in this drawer that's full of maggots that clearly are probably pasta.
Yeah, that was one thing for me was, again, the effect that they tried to use was clearly inflating and deflating some sort of bag under this pile of jellied worms. But then they zoom in to Timothy Dalton digging through, and none of them are moving. They might be wiggling slightly, but only once he's moved them. But yeah, he discovers the cocaine. And again, unusual for Bond, he gets caught from behind by a security guard.
Mm-hmm.
Who then takes a handful of maggots to the face, followed by some very large Timothy Dalton fists, and then gets thrown in the drawer with the maggots. And he does have a little quip on that one.
Bon
you remember?
Appetit. Yeah, the bon appetit. Yeah.
Bon appetit. Which I kind of, again, it's the guard's unconscious. He's on his own. I allow it. That's my rule. I'm okay with that. And then obviously second guard makes his appearance.
Yeah, and he gets the way that he's dealt with it, I always thought it's really interesting because he's basically pulled it by a hook into a tank of eels, electric eels.
And there's nothing said about it. It's just
no.
It's done, dusted. There's no shocking comments. See what I did there?
Well, there'd be some kind of, you know, come like electrifying if it was Roger Moore, something like that.
That's what I mean. It's like, you know. I bet that was a bit of a shock to him.
Yeah, or it'd be like a Sean Connery shocking line.
Yeah.
But, I mean, obviously then Bond finally sees Killifer, who is about to execute him. And again, it's only pure luck by Sharky popping up and knocking through a ground hatch and knocking him over that prevents him from being killed, because he's going to feed Bond to the shark.
Yes, Killifer catches Bond after Bond dispatches the second guard, gets him to stand on the trapdoor, not knowing he stood on the same... I think it's the same hatch that Bond came through, which is probably why Sharky's under it. Because, again, rolling back slightly, Sharky is clearly staying behind after Bond goes in. So the fact that Sharky is now gathered up the courage to go past Little Bruce and open it. It's a lot of luck. It works, and it's nice that that gets dealt with.
Well, I particularly like the way Bond deals with Killifer, which is where he's saying, "Well, I'll split the money with you."
And he keep just takes it, old, yeah. Keep it, old buddy. You yeah. keep it, old buddy, and just throws this suitcase at him.
You weren't it. You keep it and throws it at him. And the reflective instinct to grab it is what is Killifer's undoing, because he gets
he lets go of the chain he's hanging from and ends up worse than Felix.
Yeah, shark food. But it's also the great response of
shark is
saying, "What a terrible waste." And Bond looks at him kind of askance, and he's saying, like, "Money."
Yeah, yes. It's like, "How dare you?" And I'm like, no, the cash. And then we have probably one of my favourite scenes, which is the follow up to the aftermath of that, where Bond and Sharky are planning their next step, and I can't remember if it's another DEA agent.
It's Grandel Bush's character.
One
of the DEA guys.
Yeah, I always got confused as to whether it's CIA or DEA. But yeah, Grandel Bush escorts Bond to Hemingway House, and there he meets up with M.
But I'll bet the other... I will take a guess on a comment you made earlier. What you realise is how he refers to him correctly by his title.
Yes.
Yes.
Partly because, again, I do... It's just that I don't know what it is. It just makes it feel... Again, makes it feel more realistic in that, a spy would have some form of rank.
Well, he is a commander, and it's the fact that he referenced him. She goes, "This is where it ends, Commander."
Yes.
Before he leads him into Hemingway's house.
He explains about, "I can only cover up so much. Yeah. I can only cover you for you for so much." Again, reinforcing the idea of this is not Bond's purpose. Bond's purpose is for much grander things.
Yeah, because the reality is that it should be being, the way it would be looked at is that the American, law enforcement should deal with this one. Leave it to them. It's their problem. It's their country. It's their laws. It's one of their citizens who's been...
It's solely domestic.
...killed and the other one's been hurt. Leave it to it. But when it goes to Hemingway House, I remember as a... Because you see all the Ernest Hemingway cats that were the cats that live in the house. The weird toes wandering.
The six-toed cats.
Yeah. I remember as a kid seeing this when I was far too young and thinking, "Hey, oh, cats. Guys, they're stroking cats. Could it be Blofeld?" And then...
Yes. Yeah. I was like, no, Bond dropped him down a chimney.
Stainless steel. You'll have to be a real Bond there to understand that comment.
I know. But so obviously Bond gets reprimanded by M. You were supposed to be in Istanbul last night. What happened? And M trying to remind him, You're letting your emotions go through. This is, leave it to the, as you said, leave it to the locals. Felix is alive.
I always feel very sorry for Robert Brown in this situation, watching this scene, because everybody, even, you can see Timothy Dalton sweating. Everybody else is sweating.
Oh, and he's in the
He's wearing a three-piece suit.
Yeah.
it must have been horrendous.
I like to imagine that just out of shot, he's got his trousers rolled up to his knees, and he's stood in a bucket of water.
You're assuming he's wearing trousers. I'd hope they'd let him wear shorts.
That would be even better. Bermuda shorts and three-piece suit up from the waist up.
He must have been boiling.
Yeah, well, I can prove, sadly, that he was wearing trousers, because when Timothy Dalton jumps over the railing after trying to fight the other 00 agents... You see him stood, so you do see that he is unfortunately wearing trousers. So yes, I do agree, and I do find that very strange that they were willing to kill Bond, or at least the other agents were, but M wasn't, because we see the sniper in the bell tower take a shot, and then M is like, "No, there's too many people."
Well, it's...
No, it's your best agent.
Yeah. Jumping ahead, I mean, obviously what happens is he's given the ultimatum, Bond. He's saying, look, it's... He you know, as we, you know, to par- you know, not verbatim, but he's kind of saying, basically, Felix knew the risks. It's let the Americans sort it out,
yes,
and clear
yeah,
up their
yeah.
mess. And you see, to Bond, it's obviously... It's not just his friend, it's the personal thing of seeing his friend's wife being killed, which will obviously bring out memories of him. And he, you know, says that, and his wife, he tells him not to be, you know,
spare
this sentimental rubbish,
yes.
basically. Now, this is, again, I just think wonderful acting from Dalton. You see the range of anger and other emotions. But when he put, you can see him kind of basically, he's I think, what am I going to do? You know, I'm going to have to do this. And he resigns. Now, the strange thing is, this is the first time, other than saying on Mercy's Secret Service, when he sort of resigned, but didn't. This is the first time we ever seen really resign. But later on in like other films, Bond seemed to resign at the drop of a hat, left, right, and center. But yeah, he somehow manages, he manages to escape and go on the run. And as you said, M won't let him be shot. And again, I'm sure you love this, you know, says, God help you, Commander, as he runs off.
I think it's just, it's like, I could understand if it was bring him, like, listen, Bond. I would have liked a bit more clarification in the sense of, listen, Bond, you can either resign and you're sworn to the Secrecy Act, which again, nice touch.
Well, yeah, and also
M going, you know, you're still under secrecy. Act, you say anything, we'll kill you.
I have to say, I forgot to mention, I absolutely love his response to when Bond resigns. You know, this is not a country club 007.
yes. Like, you can't just hand in your membership, yeah. sir. Yeah, the country club line was a good one. And that, but as I say, I just, it's the whole thing of shooting at Bond. I can understand it in the sense of the 00 agent's probably thinking, oh God, he's going to kill M. You know,
yeah.
The sniper is probably thinking, right, if Bond is fighting now, there's a chance M could lose his life.
Well, it's also the fact that you've got to think he's kind of assaulted him because he barges at him. So really, I can see why they probably would take a shot because
yeah.
it's a, you know, protection point.
Yeah, yeah, because as you say, is he going to lunge at M? But I just, it's this idea of he is your best agent. Maybe give him a week off. Rather than just, it's your job or nothing.
I know, but to be fair, he's been on a plane for God knows how many hours. It's hot. He's probably just cranky. God damn it, man.
yeah. God damn it, Bond. Just shut up and come.
Well, I think it's kind of mentioned, there's a comment on it in the novelization of it where he's sort of saying, this is why I spend so many hours sort of thing getting here. he's not
yeah.
happy about the flight.
I think it was the idea of, M knew he had to talk him down.
Yes. Yeah.
And the only way it was even going to remotely work was, I have to do this and I have to do it face to face. A phone call's not going to work. He's just going to hang up. But if he sees that I am here to bring him home, as it were, it will have more of an effect than sending someone else or, you know, calling someone else or anything like that. So.
And then we get that shift, don't we, to Bond. He thinks he's going to be able to find Sanchez. He's on the boat, the Wave Crest.
Yes. And he goes back to tracking down Crest from the aquarium because he knows that's his strongest lead. So him and Sharky go out. Although I do love Sharky, I think Sharky's utilization in that was a bit off for me, but again, I'll let it slide. You get the scene of Crest being a dirty, dirty boy spying on Lupe.
It's also an interesting way of how Bond gets the boat, because he's under like a fake manta ray.
Yes!
Because it sets off all the security, and they're like, well, it's a manta ray. And
sets off the sonar, and then the probe, the boat has a tethered
brought back
probe.
In. Yeah,
it looks like a mini sub, but it's a remote controlled probe.
And it's the way that Bond basically has to obviously incapacitate a few people, gets through, and then he goes into the cabin, which is where Lupe is, where Crest has been perving on her. And again, it's a very cold, hard scene. So he basically says, you know, grabs her by the hair, covers her mouth and says, make a sound and you're dead. Because he's got a knife to her throat.
That was what I was about to say as well. It's not like it's a suppressed pistol like we're used to. Because that's Bond's normal MO. This is much more personal in that he's got essentially a diving knife. Because that's all he can get. Because he'd not got any of his equipment. So it's a lot more... as you say, it's a lot more thuggish. It shakes off that image, but I do love as well, I call him henchman number four. I don't know what his actual name is, but I just called him henchman number four, who is taken out first, and you see the first mention of the decompression chamber, which is aboard the boat, which will play a part later on. Well, for the tadpoles at home, not only does it play a part later on in the plot, but it's significant in the sense of, for divers, it's decompression to stop decompression sickness or the bends when they come up too quickly. So it's nice that they've not shoehorned it in. This is a boat which has divers on board, therefore it will have a decompression chamber. The fact that they also use it as a money store. Because Bond finds the bundles. And again, the bundles play on later. In fact, in the action sequence, just after this scene. But I also like the fact that he comments on Lupe's marks.
The scars, yeah.
On the scars on her back. And I just find it's nice that he is still trying to be the good guy, and yet it's the hypocrisy of him saying, well, I'll gut you like a fish, but I'm upset that Lupe has been smacked by Sanchez. You know, putting aside the
fact that Bond himself is a psychopath.
And has done probably worse to others. And will do worse in later iterations.
But it's interesting, isn't it? Because he obviously, you know, gets Lupe, again, holding her at knife point, though, because Crest is saying, what's going on? She's going, I know nothing. I've been asleep. You know, go away, did it? But then we get that scene where we see Sharky has been killed. And it's it shows how messed up the people are who kill him, because they're treated as a joke. And again, the rage, the cold rage that Don does so well, where he basically is going, you know, well, the line, you know, you've got to find yourself a new lover.
And then the fact that Sharky is strung up next to other sharks shows that the absolute contempt and lack of humanity. So when he kills the diver with the harpoon gun,
it's the way the diver's going, oh, guess what, his name was Sharky, and laughing.
Yes, you overhear that passing comment of his name really was Sharky, or something similar to that. So Bond harpooning him, saying courtesy of Sharky,
and it's quite a cool action sequence, isn't it? Because it's underwater, and then you have. I don't know who the stunt double was, but, you know, war scheme behind the plane that he's, because he harpooned it to get onto it.
I was actually going to say as well, one of the things I love about that fight scene is the added element of the oxygen tanks. It has been done before.
Oh, yes, yes.
Spy Who Loved Me has done it as well. But the idea of the man that Bond first kills, he takes his scuba gear, and whilst he's trying to... hide from the other divers, you see him check his regulator and see that he's running out of oxygen, so he's got to be careful. And then he gets in a fight and ends up having his airline cut anyway, but uses the distraction to grab onto the probe, which we then discover is full of cocaine.
That's true.
This is how the product is moved. This is how he uncovers the fact that they're using what they're calling oceanic mapping, or you know, searching for wildlife, they're actually using it to rendezvous with a pontoon plane where the drugs and the money are exchanged. So the money's put back into the probe, the probe returns, and then the product goes off to the cartels. Mm-hmm. And as you say, Bond harpoons onto it. We get the barefoot water skiing, which is, again, another wonderful stunt. And then I've got in my notes, it's Bond turns into Bond meets Twilight Zone as he looks like, a little gremlin crawling around the plane trying to get into it. And he does the wonderful climbs in the opposite door.
Yep.
And then
which you think somebody would notice, but, you know,
yeah, again, disbelief.
It's a Bond film.
Small plane, but yeah, he does kick him out. And then we discover that apparently money is bulletproof.
Depends how much you've got.
Yeah, I mean, I have to admit, those cubes are quite large. So, but yeah, Bond defeats the pilot by hitting him in the face with what looks like a square foot cube of money, which, as mentioned, takes two bullets first and then hits him with it. And then he throws the pilot out, which is a nice touch, because they actually go to recover him, which I thought was very odd.
Well, they're probably just going to, you know, find out what the hell went on and then get rid of him. But it's it's interesting.
I would have thought they just let him drown.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because Bond is basically, I can't remember, does he then, off the top of my head, is it that where he's looking in the computer to find out? Yeah, because he's got to find out where he can
So
he goes through a list of agents who are pretty much all dead.
He goes to the informants list. So yes. What happens is Bond takes the money from the pontoon boat because the deal never went through. During the fight scene previously, Bond stabs all the cocaine.
Yes,
so it goes into the sea. That's why they suddenly surface. So the deal never actually goes through. But Bond takes the money that's in the back of the plane, obviously hides that somewhere safe, and then returns to Felix's house, hops the fence to avoid the police, goes into his office, finds the photo of Della, finds her photograph, finds the hidden disc, and as you say, puts it in the computer. We find out he finds the informants list, and he gets the name of the sole surviving informant, and he finds out there was a meeting due to be arranged. And again, scrolling back through the film, we actually meet this informant at the wedding.
Mm.
Bond actually gets a glimpse of her during the wedding where she's passing some information to Felix.
I also love the fact that in that scene we see the wonders, and we've seen it already earlier on, of a giant CD writer drive of the time.
The mighty 512 megabytes.
And a gold disc.
it's amazing what you... And dot matrix display.
Hey, gotta love that dot matrix. It's like aliens in the future. Everything's been run on DOS.
yeah. But it's, again, technology aside, we discover the identity of the informant, and Bond makes his way via cigar boat. Again, I can only assume that's Felix's. Or
I don't know. I think it's probably one he just bought with the money. Because he's
fleeing
that. You don't think so? Because he's fleeing that money around like no one's business when he hands the guy and goes, put it in Stern.
Not until... I don't think it is, because I think it's... He does tip him well, which is a point. But
he kisses the money, doesn't he?
Yeah, because he's like... Good. Yeah, so it's possible, but so we meet at the what I put in my notes as the titty bar with two exclamation marks.
See, yeah, I agree. It's a strange.
It's not just a bar.
It. Yeah, I don't mind it, but it's like someone said. He obviously meets meets Pam there, and you know, to talk about guns, she's packing a proper gun, not a wolf.
Yes, that was funny. She's like, are you armed? Opens his jacket.
How do you get a shotgun into a bar?
Yeah, where was she hiding it? Because it's not like she was wearing leather trousers and a leather vest. Like, you, I'm sorry, but you need at least a trench coat to hide a sawn off. It's a pump action shotgun, and it's just such the measuring contest when it's like, I've got a 38 Walther, I've got a 12 gauge. I think I'll be doing the plating. And then,
she hit the deck, doesn't she? So,
well, she does, and then she has. As I've got again in my notes, it says the goon squad assembles, because as they're talking, they realise that they're being set up. James and Pam are discussing further actions and what they're going to do. The goon squad of Sanchez's henchmen come into the bar, and again we get a fantastic scene with Benicio del Toro. He comes and sits down at the table with Pam and Bond. Pam immediately points a shotgun in his ghoulies, which I think most of us can agree is not the nicest way to meet someone. And then we get into probably what is the worst thing any firearms enthusiast wants to see on television, which is a negligent discharge. Pam is knocked in her seat to the point where she blows a hole through the table instead of Benicio del Toro.
The point you were saying about, you know, the shotgun, I mean, it's a kind of a weird, I don't mind the scene, but I don't love it, because Bond in a bar fight, bit different, but believable, I guess, so.
Well, certainly the way it starts, in the fact that it goes from a disagreement at a table to an all-out brawl with everyone.
And that, I love the music in it. I didn't used to do, but Dirty Love, I think, is an absolutely brilliant song.
Yeah.
And I'll plug them. Cue the Music, who perform Bond music, do an amazing rendition of it. And again, I'm going to plug a previous episode. I interviewed Warren Ringham, who is the creator of Cue the Music on this. So, you know, on the podcast.
I do. So, I did like the music. I did like the fact that it immediately stopped. Well, it didn't immediately stop. It's almost, but nothing happens. Pam just Pam blows a giant hole in the wall.
Perfectly round.
Yes, perfectly round and human sized from 12 gauge buckshot, which immediately stops everyone fighting, because it's like the uppage of the guns weren't in play until the negligent discharge when she blew through the table. That started the whole fight. So it is that nice thing of, yeah, okay, guns have come out now. It's a bit more serious. So then they make their escape. I also mentioned the swordfish.
Yeah.
That was a bit Roger Moore, that one, when a guy picks I don't even think it's a taxidermy swordfish. It looks like it's just fiberglass.
True. I mean, you do always get to see that look of shock on Bond's face, like, what?
Well, yeah, when it comes through the chair that he's got up, he's holding up a chair like a lion tamer, and a swordfish comes through it. But obviously they make their escape in Bond's cigar boat.
Leaking cigar boat.
Yes, his leaking cigar boat. Pam gets shot in the back, which we discover is a bulletproof vest, which I like Bond's reaction to that as well, in that you can kind of tell he doesn't actually care about her. He cares about the fact that his informant's dead.
Yes.
Or he at least believes that. So when it turns out she's okay, and she comments on, isn't Kevlar wonderful, and you can see the relief on his face. You can tell it's not relief that the fact she's alive, it's the fact that he is still going to get his information.
Yeah, and it's that, you know, there's a realism, because he reprimands her. Does he swear at her? Yeah, because he goes, she's really lucky to be alive.
Yes, yes. That's something, that, again, the language is a huge jump.
Yes.
You start noticing a lot more. Carrie Lowell, who plays Pam, she screams out bullshit to Q's face. Yes. Later on.
Yes.
Which, you can, you know, I'm like, how dare you speak to Desmond Llewellyn like that? How dare you?
But it's an interesting scene because, as you kind of mentioned, you know, Bond's totally on his own because when he's saying to her, right, I'm going to get Sanchez, and she's going, well, who have you got? And he goes, well, me and you. And she's like, you're nuts.
You'd have to have a whole army to take him on. No, it's fine. It's just me. And then I got in my notes, it's like, it's early woman go rah moment where she's like, I'm ex-army. I've flown in some of the worst places ever. And it's, and he's just like, and?
Yeah,
I've saved the world millions of times. It's fine.
Well, when they run out of fuel and she's like mocking him, going, "No, I've been out for a long time. Run out of gas and they're drifting." And you know, the hit upon a deal for the amount of money she's going to have and the kiss. It's interesting because I remember listening to an interview with Carrie Llewellyn. She was saying that she'd wanted to kind of be tougher with it, kissing him.
Yeah,
but he wanted it more gentle. Because she reckons she would have been a tougher character with him. But
oh, she would have made the move on him.
Yeah, yeah, which I can believe if you think about her character.
Yeah, and because, again, it's the juxtaposition of the two conversations. It goes from berating each other to kissing because they've agreed to be paid.
And being a Bond film, they've got to get the romance moving.
Yeah, which... Again, and the interesting touch is the fact that technically we have two Bond girls in this one.
Yes, yes. This is
so true. That is. I found it a bit jarring. This idea of you pay for the fuel, you find the plane. Like they're still drifting out in the middle of the sea in a cigar boat that won't move. But yeah, it's fine. Just have a snog while you're at it. It's fine.
I wonder how long it took them to get to shore.
I don't know. When she sits on the horn.
Oh, yeah. We're in Carry On Bond. That could be Roger Moore style territory.
That was definitely. Although, again, also kind of reminds me of Zack Snyder. Watchmen.
Oh, God, yeah. I've never ever thought of that, but that's true. Yeah, I wonder if he did.
Yeah, it is the superhero kind of... stereotype of well, now we know what's happening because the flamethrower went off. Symbolism. now we've got the horn going off. We know what's going to happen now. But yeah, I put in my notes sexy negotiations on a boat with no fuel.
But then we cut to like Isthmus City, which is Sanchez's heart of his operations, where he lives.
Don't we? No, not immediately.
Go on.
You missed the stock footage because interesting fact about this film, none of it was filmed in the UK. It was the first Bond film not to be filmed in the UK due to they slashed the budget of this film compared to the last and they genuinely couldn't afford it. So there's stock footage of jolly old England. We get to see some red buses going up and down. That's how you know it's stock footage. And it's just a quick jump back to MI6, and it's Moneypenny, because Moneypenny plays a very important role in this film. And this scene explains it all in that Moneypenny actually informs Q, because M and Moneypenny have a chat, because Moneypenny informs M that Bond has still not left the United States. M kind of glosses over it, and Moneypenny's like, well, I thought you'd like to know that he's still, you haven't heard from him. And obviously this is because Moneypenny she loves Bond. They have a very unique relationship, but she truly cares for him. So she calls Q, and then it cuts back to, what's the town called?
Isthmus City.
Yeah, Isthmus City. Cuba.
Yeah, I have to slap myself for not remembering this, because he is, you get a tearful Moneypenny ringing to speak to Q Branch to try and get some help for Bond. But
because she knows that Q is the only one who would...
Yeah.
The only one who can do that without, you know, like, getting told off, kind of
thing.
The
craziness of this scene, though, the total craziness is, you would think, okay, where was this shot? It's one little scene. So I remember speaking to Caroline Bliss, and she was saying that they flew them out to Mexico to film this.
Mm.
This one small scene. And I remember asking her, I said, well, was anything missing? Did you film more? Was anything cut? And she went, yeah. She was saying that most of her friends had said, Caroline, was there more to do? And no, that was it.
It was literally that scene just to have it done.
And I really wish they'd given her more. I think she deserved more than just that one scene.
I agree, but I also understand why there was a lack of her. Because, again, it's not an MI6 story.
Mm.
So the idea that she would have minimal involvement does kind of make sense.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite sad, because I believe it's the last time Caroline actually played the role on screen. So again, it is sad that the last performance was essentially a bit part.
But hey, they flew her out first class to Mexico, so, you know.
Exactly.
Could be worse.
It could have been worse. She could have ended up in China.
Which is where I think they'd once considered filming.
Yes, they accepted an invitation from the government of China because later on the Hong Kong drug department get involved with the storyline, and there were going to be scenes filmed on the Great Wall of China as well as the Emperor's tomb with the terracotta soldiers. And I believe it is due to the budget cuts that they had to basically annex all of that. And Mexico was just cheaper. Plus, it does fit more with the... I think if it had become more globe-trotting, then it's more like a Bond film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you'd have to argue the logistics. You know, Bond's got no gear. He's got no backup. How's he going to get around the world?
And it's also one of the things when people take the complaint a bit about the wardrobe in this for Bond. He's on a limited wardrobe. If you think about it, he's basically been on holiday and then all he's got is the gear that he had on holiday with him. So he's on a very limited amount of stuff that he'd actually have. It's real. That's a level of realism I like. You know, they go to but it cuts to the scene where they're in the hotel, don't they? You know, he's flashing the cash around that he's using Sanchez's money and rather crudely reprimands
Ms. Kennedy.
Yeah. Ms. Kennedy for her clothing, making out she's his secretary, which cuts nice to the fact when he goes, basically, get yourself some nice clothes, etc., and explains why.
Oh, she does.
The wig she's wearing is, we see her real hair later on, because Bond has to make a deposit of all the cash, and he finds out the best place to go is the bank owned by Sanchez.
I think that's more of a, it's a wink and a nod to the audience of, I'm going to make a deposit and just so happen to be, it just so happens to be the same bank. But it kind of makes sense, because again, Bond gets a lay of the land and he gets to see the fact that Sanchez and what appears to be a group of Triad members are discussing the operations of the bank. And that's, again, it's a nice element of how they introduce the third almost antagonist, being the Hong Kong Department of the Police, who are also trying to get Sanchez, because this leads to a massive cock-up in a few scenes, which we will discuss when we get there. But yeah, we see Sanchez upstairs in the casino watching the televangelist, and I thought that was absolutely, it was such a brilliantly written cover story. The idea being that the goal that the televangelist wants to raise is the price of the kilos of coke. And the amount that donations come in from different cities. So a church in Chicago donates $500, which we then find out is code for 500 kilos at what, again, we discover that the 22,000 is the new price per kilo. I really thought that was such a wonderful way of covering those kind of, you know, it was such the brazen nature of being so open about it, yet having such a interesting code method I really like that as a way of getting around things.
I'd agree. Bless your heart.
Yes, bless your heart.
But it is cool that seeing that whole centerpiece. You know, Sanchez has all these people, and then we cut to Bond and you know Pam going into the casino where he's betting.
The ugliest casino chips.
Very true. Within this scene, they also have a real. They've always had a go at Dalton over his hairstyle in this, where he combs all his hair back.
Yeah, because he's got a widow's peak.
Yeah, which he can't help. He's got receding hairline. It is what it is.
But it is very much a. It looks. It's very Nicolas Cage.
Yes, I mean, I kind of think the reason they change it. It's not the worst hairstyle they could have, but I think the reason they do it is probably because either he's maybe trying to change his appearance a bit and. I don't know, slick back hair fashion of the time, maybe.
Possibly. It could also be the fact of it's all he could do. I mean, going back to the climate thing, it could literally be it's just the humidity.
Mm-hmm.
No matter what they tried to do to make work, nothing looked right on camera other than just slick it all back.
But he did. Yeah, I mean, I like it, the scene how he's gambling and he's up a load of money and one of the guys calls him a jerk off.
Yeah, and he's just like this British jerk off wants to raise the limits, and it's just like I do. And again, I like the introduction of Lupe.
Yes.
The one thing I found interesting was they've got cameras for the tables, but not microphones.
Yeah, because he sends Pam off to get him a drink, so he can get him shaken up third, and she's not happy, but.
No, she calls the barman a wanker in sign language.
Yeah. But, he understands then.
Shaken, not stirred. Not stirred.
But, yeah, your point is because Lupe basically says, I used to work here. And he said, well, I'll lose. And she goes, yeah, we'll take a bit, but not a lot, you know, sort of thing. Take some of his money. And he manages to walk away to another table because he's going, I better quit for the night, goes to another table. Or somewhere else, and he's talking to us saying, I've got to see Sanchez, and you're right. How has nobody else picked up on this?
But it's the fact that he's very forceful with her. He's pulling her round by the elbow in the casino. It's not like he's just like, she slipped him a key card with some of the chips, and like, this will get you in the elevator. It is a genuine ragging around the casino going, you listen here, you. You show me where he is right now.
Yeah,
take me.
But again, Bond's the craziness that is Bond, that this isn't about a mission. This is like a complete personal thing for him.
He's got no cover to keep, really.
No.
So I do.
Well, I guess maybe he feels he's got nothing to lose.
Or he's willing to lose everything.
Yeah, yeah.
To achieve the end goal. But yeah, when they go upstairs, he meets Sanchez. He's walking around the office. You get the close up of the bulletproof glass.
Mm-hmm.
When he's commenting on the view.
I also like the way he introduces himself. It's not like they're trying to do the whole thing building up the tension of Bond, James Bond that they do in a lot of films. It's a realistic. He puts his hand out, you know.
Yeah.
To introduce himself.
And I also like the fact of he manages to keep calm. It's not just I'm in the office, I'm going to blow his brains out and shoot my way back out of the office kind of thing.
Which couldn't do anyway because it disarmed him.
It's true. They do disarm him. And annoyingly, they keep it.
Yes, yes.
Which I think that's it's a nice little nod to the fact that Sanchez isn't as dumb as people want to believe.
Hmm.
Like, he's being cautious. You don't need a gun, senor. You know, we're in a safe city. You know, I thought that was nice. As I'm going to keep your passport. I'm going to keep your firearm.
Yeah.
Until I know.
Yeah, because he's looking into him of who he is, but it's also the way he's they're talking about why he's there. And he's saying, "You know, I'm temporarily unemployed. I want a job." And he's saying, "You've got to show a skill that nobody else has. He said that will be too difficult, you know, really dissing the guys who are around.
He's like, it wouldn't be too difficult.
Yeah.
And then eyes up the bodyguards, is like, I'll take all of you out.
Who understand the little piss?
Yeah,
off.
Yeah. I also like after this scene, as I say, I like that Sanchez doesn't quite take the bait immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And we get a glorious cameo from Kari Hiroyuki Kagawa, who is the Hong Kong drug department. He's also the original villain in Mortal Kombat.
Your soul
is mine.
But I also, I mean, going back to the scene of, you know, Bond and Sanchez across the desk, I like the fact that he's talked about his work and he described himself not as a problem solver, but more of a problem eliminator. And there's that knowing laugh of the two lunatics, basically.
Of just like...
Battle the nasty bastards, basically.
They know the code. Yeah. He uses that code well. But yeah, just... I like the introduction of the... You start seeing the triad, and then we have probably my favorite, one of my other favorite scenes in the film, which is Bond goes back to the hotel with Pam, and the receptionist informs him that he has a visit from his uncle, which leads to an absolutely fantastic introduction of Q with Timothy Dalton barging.
Prior to that, though, I love the way in the lift how he says, you know, let's make it a proper family union. Give me your gun.
Yes.
A great line.
Yeah. You're only saying that because Pam then pulls off the lower half of her skirt.
I couldn't possibly comment. But what I do also like is the fact that he's given a Beretta.
Yes.
Which is the proper, is the original gun Bond had.
Beretta Cougar, I believe.
Taken off him. Yeah, until he's taken off him.
Yeah, because again, in the beginning, he says it always gets snagged on the holster in Dr. No. Yes. So yeah, that's a nice little nod from when he's re-equipped for that one. And yeah, it's just Desmond Llewellyn getting knocked on his backside over a chair. And it's Bond's absolute genuine concern. I'm gonna bloody kill you.
How very true. Yeah, it's the reality of showing that, you know, Bond would be dead without assistance from Q Branch, because he's saying you'd be dead long ago. He's given him gadgets that he can use.
Yes, his travel gadgets, as I called it, because he just opens the suitcase and is like, right, what do you need? Here's an exploding alarm clock. Here's some exploding toothpaste.
And a weird camera, a weird Polaroid.
And a camera gun that only fires to your palm print.
Well, and also the weird camera that has a laser built in.
Laser and X-ray function.
Yeah, why?
Well, one, Q. Two, I noticed as well, I think there's a missing joke in that scene.
Go on.
Well, you notice that when Pam looks at the photograph, Q and Bond are skeletal because it's an X-ray.
Yes.
But the painting is also showing up. And I was thinking, was that going to be a joke of there's actually someone spying on them from inside the wall?
Hmm.
And the laser in the flash took them out.
That would have been good. That would have been very good.
Because they do that later in Die Another Day.
Mm.
When Bond is in Hong Kong in the hotel room, he throws a tumbler through the mirror.
Mm-hmm.
And it shatters, and you see all the Hong Kong officers behind with the cameras. So I think that would... I don't know whether it's a missing joke or it had to be cut. Because
maybe
they still use that
whole scene. Or maybe you've just come up with the scene they should have put in.
Yeah. Because, again, they still use that hotel room. So I think it's one of those things of it could have been done. But I think the fact that they return there, you wouldn't do that if you then discovered there's a rotting corpse with a laser wound to his forehead. behind the picture of
the room would be a bit
Presidente.
Stinky.
You'd think so. And I do. I love the line where it's like, we're all going to go to bed. I hope you don't snork, you.
I mean, yeah. And I like the fact that when Bond has basically been acquitted and he's going off to the casino to basically prepare to kill Sanchez, he has to get on the roof and whatnot. We see Bond appearing as Bond would generally appear at certain things where he pretends to be a waiter. And,
yes, I was just I like the fact that it's Bond the bellboy to get up on he uses his bellboy cover to get onto the roof. He then equips his abseiling cummerbund,
which is a pretty cool little thing to have. It kind of makes sense that there'll be something in the cummerbund, and when he's on the roof, because he's obviously had to put toothpaste, doesn't he? The dentin.
He does. He puts the toothpaste explosive around the window frame, and annoyingly, they show him use a really cool gadget. And I mean, I knew cigarettes could kill, but Bonds are even worse.
Ah, the Lark cigarette, yeah.
Yeah. Lark
cigarette. Nice bit of sponsorship there.
Well, it does make me wonder whether it was merchandising, because none of the cigarettes are actually featured. Because in the plot, his box of cigarettes is actually a remote detonator.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So he plants that, and at the same time, we hear the Triad discussing deals with Sanchez, and they arrange the compound visit.
You also get that signature John Glenn thing of a startled animal creating a problem.
Yes, that pigeon. Bond nearly gets caught by a pigeon.
But I do particularly like the scene when it comes to Bond, where he's putting the signature gun together from it's designed like a high, I guess a high tech camera, and he's all lined up to shoot him. And he gets the shock of seeing, because he goes to another room and sees
Kennedy Bond. And it's Kennedy
Heller, the head of security.
Yeah, and he's a bit taken aback, but he still goes for the shot. I have to admit as well, did you notice something weird about the shooting?
Go on.
The window falls out in a single piece.
It's true.
And I think the reason behind that, because, again, for the tadpoles who are still managing to listen to us.
You will listen, tadpoles. You will listen. Keep going. Stay to the end.
Come on, we're almost there. We're almost there.
Yeah. But, prove Gemma wrong.
Yeah. But as I said, the weirdest thing is, I think that was because, again, the building that they were using, they couldn't blow a window out.
Mm-hmm. I can believe
that. I think that's actually a doorway that they've put this fake frame into and had to use as little explosive as possible. Because I think you can actually see the whole framed window just kind of fall back into the office to open it up.
We also get some brilliant Philips sponsorship, who are sponsoring a lot of the Bond films at this point with this little gadget where he uses to blow the window, but you also have him swearing again, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Which is a bit unusual with Bastard.
I also found it weird. I found it weird that his trigger mechanism had a radar on it for some reason.
That's true. I can only assume it's maybe meant to be, it's part of whatever it's meant to be, but it's interesting that also you get that the cutscene where you're seeing the influence Sanchez has, where he's talking to the mayor.
Yes.
No, the president, sorry.
And El Presidente, and it's like, where's your president check so for light?
Life? Yeah, you're only president for life.
Yeah, and he said your payment was a little lighter, and it's like, yes, you didn't make a lot of fuss when I was in prison, so
grateful. The president is also played by the son of the man who played, was it Karim Bey or something from Russia with Love.
Hmm.
I can't remember myself. But it's, yeah, and then obviously Bond falls foul of ninjas.
Got off
ninjas in an 80s film. Action
it's
ninjas.
It's the 80s. Has to be ninjas. And I actually like the fact that Bond gets his arse handed to him.
Oh, he does. He gets it handed to him.
And it's bloody.
Yes.
Like, yeah. He gets a nasty gash to the head. And then he wakes up tied to a table.
Up to this point, I'd always question how hurt. I mean, you see it with Craig, certainly, but would you ever see Bond this badly hurt in films? Probably not.
Not up until then. Bond always seemed to escape, at least cleanly.
Yeah, he was quite Teflon.
Pretty much, in the sense of, you know, he'd just brush it off. And, like, Bond would never have to cut, like, his villains wouldn't get the upper hand. Mm. He would be distracted. You know, he'd get cornered and disarmed. And then something that he'd set up previously would bear fruit.
And so on the early actors, their hairpieces remained remarkably in place.
Well, again, yeah, I think it was a case of rugs flying everywhere would not look. the budget would have exploded just on lost wigs.
Well, it was like the joke once on an episode of, I think it was Big Train with Bond, that he's going to the Bond's going to the Bongo. You can do anything you can with a man half my age, apart from run your hands through my hair.
But yeah, Bond wakes up strapped to a table, being interrogated by two ninjas and a Hong Kong narcotics officer.
And interestingly, one of his own men turns up to try and knock him out, because Bond certainly finds out that he's screwing everything up for the Hong Kong people.
Yes. But, yeah. I don't know whether it's another 00 agent or whether it's a liaison.
Well, I always wonder if he could be the head of their people in that area. And I think I remember I've seen he was in Ghostbusters 2 as a head waiter in the restaurant. That's a strange point to remember, but I think it probably is him. But yeah, he's going to knock him out basically with pills and with a shot, and then
yes,
again swearing because he tells him to piss off when he's asking him where did he get this stuff.
Who are you with? Who are you working for?
This belongs to the government. Where? How did you get your hands on this?
Yeah, this is government equipment. How did you get your hands on it? It shouldn't be here. Piss off. Very groggy.
Which is always fun when they show License to Kill during the day on television, because they cut all the swearing out amongst the other scenes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You are correct. The president's father was in From Russia with Love.
Yes. So, but
Amandaris Sr.
Excellent. But the most unlikely saviour for Bond at this point is actually
Sanchez.
He's
a tank!
Yeah. Sanchez. Hella. Sanchez, a tank, and
yes, and the not Cuban army,
and the fact that the Hong Kong narcotics guy takes cyanide rather than taking alive.
Yeah, and again he tells his female ninja the same: don't be taken alive. But I like how it's fortuitous, and it's not just fortuitous in the sense of. He was going to kill the triad anyway, because we didn't actually know that at that point. It's also the fact of it helps Bond with his cover, because Sanchez now thinks he's on Sanchez's side.
Yes.
Because he's like, well, they tried to kill him, so clearly he's not here to do anything bad to me, because they're trying to stop him. Maybe he is on the level. No, it's nice that you start seeing that kind of second guessing.
Mm-hmm. And Bond's lucky enough that he's taken and wakes up in Sanchez's mansion.
Yes.
Very interesting decor.
Yes, the fish face.
Hmm.
I remember when he wakes up and I'm like, yes, I'd be terrified of that too.
Yeah, and he's been looking to have all his clothes cleaned and pressed.
It's a brand new suit.
Ah.
It's a brand new suit for him. Because obviously his other one was tattered. Because despite the male ninja's best efforts of dying on top of Bond, he does get a bit battered up when the house collapses.
But he manages to get up. You know, he goes and has a nice cup of coffee and a smoke with Sanchez, where Sanchez quizzes him about what's going on. And Bond's smart enough to basically say, oh, yes, there were people who were must have been paid and very well briefed.
Yes.
And he starts feeding. Because the big thing with Sanchez is he's obsessed by loyalty. And you see this throughout the film. He's obsessed by people being loyal to him. So Bond sows the seed of doubt in his mind.
That's where it all starts, yeah.
It's been started by somebody within his operation.
Yeah, and it's... I do like that he controls his emotions. Any lesser of an actor would show struggle with, you know, having to be nicey-nicey with this guy, knowing what he's done. But Dalton understands that, no, I would be a consummate professional because I want this to go right. So I am going to be nice to him and act like the Bond that he knows is nothing like the real Bond.
And so Dalton does have a strange accent slip in the scene, though.
Yes.
Which is where he goes very northern with the word nasty.
Yes. That,
to be fair, I've gathered Timothy Dalton did spend quite a lot of time in Manchester, so I think he may have grown up in there for a point in his life. So, yeah, interesting. But the whole way he gets off the island is interesting, where he gets Lupe to help him get off the island. And clings to a boat.
Yeah. I'm just going shopping. Bye. And poor Bond, like, that, but what on about for the dear poor, life.
What about the poor person who's there to stop her?
God, that's yes. It's
that poor man. He's like, please don't go, please.
That's probably one of the most realistic portrayals is, oh, I'm so dead.
Quite literally, I bet he did get killed.
Yeah. That's the only thing I'm not surprised is, you know, there wasn't a, oh, where's he gone? Oh, I dealt with him. You left the island. I dealt with him. So he's definitely a uncredited death.
And how did you feel? Because obviously Bond returns to the hotel thinking that the dirt has been done to him by Pam. And he goes like, psychopath. What did you think of that scene? Because that's a bit of a different thing. You know, he's unkempt looking, he's tired, he's very
again,
stubbly.
Having being shot at, a house fall on him, dragged through the sea. I'm surprised it didn't take I'm surprised it took him as long as it did to find her, because I'd want to know immediately. But again, it was a nice scene of Bond trying to remind everyone why he's here. Because something else I noticed is he keeps trying to get rid of people.
Yeah.
Every opportunity he can, he keeps trying to say, like, when they first arrive at the hotel, Bond tries to pay off Pam. And he's like,
yes.
Go away. Yeah. And she refuses. And it's this scene that explains it, and it's the introduction of the Stinger missiles, which is why Hela is still there, because you would think at this point Hela's not really needed. But then you realize he's providing Stinger missiles, and this is where Pam reveals what she knew and what she was giving to Felix, the fact that it was that she provided the Stinger missiles for her freedom, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, it's
and
something
the deal
along those
was
going to
go
yeah.
through until Bond blew the window out, which made Hela turn tail, and he said, the next time I see you, I'm going to kill you.
Yeah, and Bond's gone like, he's going like, he's controlling his rage and not shooting her, because he pulls her other firearm from her.
Thigh
holster, and he's like holding her at gunpoint, and he realizes there's more to do, and he can actually still resolve the situation. And as you said, he is trying to get rid of people, because he loosely tells Q to like basically bugger off.
Well, he keeps telling, because you're not a field agent.
Yes.
And it's like, I know, but you are, and you need me. I do like that element with Q. But the other thing I felt with Pam was, it's Bond's realization of he may have cocked up.
Yes, yes.
Because Pam had an out. If he hadn't done what he did, Pam would have been safe.
Mm.
He could have still gone after Sanchez. Could have still stopped him before Sanchez got hold of the Stinger missiles. And I think it's that realization of, by he's realizing how emotional he's getting and how he's not thinking through. And you start seeing him take it slightly more like a normal mission. And we start slightly getting back to, I'd say, proper Bond. But, you know, we do start getting back to Bond.
Well, he has, as they would say, dropped a ricker. Things have gone a bit wrong. So,
just a smidge.
But it's yeah, because he obviously then, he doesn't, yeah, he has to get back. But his big push is that he started sowing lots of doubt into the mind of Sanchez. And
the setup of Crest.
Which is something else, really, isn't it? Yeah, they get onto
fab.
Back on the boat, they've got the money in the
decompression chamber.
The decompression chamber. And obviously,
which, again, ties back to the transaction that failed. Because, again, Sanchez mentions previously in one of the scenes about missing money and that, you know, Crest is on thin ice, and Bond sets this up by returning the money to Crest's decompression chamber.
Well, the other thing he's done is he's getting Lupe is there to try and be a witness, or Crest would hope she's a witness, and she's like, oh, I know nothing. I know none of this.
Yes. I don't remember his face. I don't remember anything about it.
Well, she knows anything. She's going like, you know, so you tell me this guy flew away like a bird.
And yes.
Obviously, they find the whole distraction thing of having Pam pretending to be the harbour pilot and crashing into the harbour and all these things going on. And when the money's found, Sanchez goes completely ape, throws Crest into the decompression chamber, and then basically cranks the pressure up.
Cranks the pressure and then cuts the valve, venting it immediately, so that the equalization in pressure results in explosive decompression of Crest.
It's like a popping pea. A scene that most of the time was kind of really cut down, because his head just goes boom.
Yeah, but as I was saying, this is the scene that I mentioned at the start of the podcast. It's one of the few scenes where an aging effect still works. Like, if you freeze it on the frame of his head inflating, yes, it does look a bit rubbery. But by viewing it solely through the porthole, which then gets splattered in blood, it preserves the effect much more so than having a camera inside the chamber and seeing a body explode.
And again, you've got to think, if you were watching this at the time, this is not what you would expect from Bond at all. Well, you wouldn't have ever seen this with Roger Moore style of Bond, would you? People's heads going pop. Not this bloodily. I mean, you'd have
Karanga.
Karanga, you know, Mr. Big going boom, but not like his bits flying everywhere.
Again, when Karanga explodes, it looks like a sofa's been blown up.
it's
weird. It's just bits of fabric and what looks like foam. Like, as you said, there's no blood. But in this one, it's, you know, it's only a flash against the porthole, but it's enough to show it to you.
And the noise of it as well. But I mean, you get the now. This ties in perfectly to what you said earlier, which is the comedy lines are not going to bond so much.
No,
you know, it's the people around him, because they're saying, "Pedro, what about the money?" And the line of, you know, launder it.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a double entendre. It's comedy.
Yeah. And I was that way again. It's just like, that's cold. That was you know, but it's it, as you say, it is the better. It is the better idea of, you know, being more realistic. Like,
yeah,
you do have to be slightly mad to make a joke after killing someone.
And it's the fact that obviously, you know, Bond basically tells Pam, he tells Q, right, you're done, go home, it's over, it's me on my own now. He manages to somehow get back to Sanchez.
Yes! I was going to say, that scene where he's
somehow.
Well, it's not just that as well. It's like the kid who's been caught out of bed.
Yes, totally. Yeah, because
he's under the covers and he's like, what? No, I've been asleep all night.
Yeah, and then he's taken his shirt off, but he's kept
when Sanchez leaves,
on.
He gets out of the bed and he realizes he's dressed from the waist down. But again,
it's also interesting that when you look at him in this film, he's got like scars,
yes,
on his body, which you didn't really see with Bond much.
No. But yeah, again, you get the that wonderful, another good scene of sowing the doubts of, it's like, you know, Bond lays the groundwork for, you know, the one, just the one. Do you know what I mean?
It's brilliant. Yeah,
when he's just like, "Are you sure you've got them all?" Because again, he's trying to destroy as much as he can. So that gets supplanted, and then Sanchez invites him on the tour with the triad.
And I can kind of see, you might think, well, why would he do that? But he's obviously seen Bond as quite a useful person.
Well, again, it's mentioned further on, previously, when Bond first wakes up in Sanchez's place, Hella goes, "You won't believe what I found out about this guy."
Oh, God, yes.
And Sanchez goes, "He's a British agent."
Yeah, because Bond's fed him a bit of information. Well,
And he fed him the truth. "I'm a former British agent." Which, again, if Heller was to check his contacts, that's what would come up, because he's resigned.
Yes, that's true. Yeah.
So he tells the truth and Sanchez bites. So it's that inner circle moment of, you've shown that I can trust you, even though you've manipulated me for the entire film.
I'm sorry, but when you said the truth, all I can think of is that scene in The Simpsons when Marge is selling houses, real estate, and Lionel's going, "There's the truth." Lionel's going, "There's the truth and the truth."
Yeah. There's the truth, nodding.
Yeah, that's the one, the nodding.
The truth.
The murder house.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, unfortunately, we get the love triangle moment where Lupe spends the night with Bond.
But within that, I do like the fact that Lupe, when he's saying, "We'll make sure you get home," and Lupe presents a realistic portrayal, and she says, "I spent years trying to get away from that. I don't want to go back." It's like,
yeah,
I don't want to go back to that place. It was a shithole.
Yeah. Look, listen, he's a psychopath, but at least he got me out of there.
How bad must there have been?
yeah, exactly. I'm willing to take on a psychotic murderer because home's worse. Fair enough. And then, of course, she goes and snitches to Pam and Q in the morning.
I love that scene.
Just knocks on the door. Pam thinks it's Bond. It's the snarky impression that Pam does. When Lupe leaves. "Oh, I love James."
Yeah. But it's also the way she kind of like oddly, like, I don't know the way, either it's what Talisa Soto's wearing, but she kind of like, she's got like an odd kind of walk into the room, like a kind of stumble bounce. But it's like this thing when she's smoking, she's going, you know, Pam's going, "I haven't had one of these in 5 years." And that comment of, you know, when she's saying, "I was with Bond last night, I love him," etc., the usual kind of thing you'd expect. And he's like, you know, she's upset and he's going, you know, he must use everything at his disposal.
Q's just stood there going, I don't know. I'm not normally here for this bit.
Yeah, I don't he does roll his eyes. This way he's like, she's like, just the bullshit line.
Yeah. And as I said, it's just like, how dare you speak to Desmond Llewellyn like that? The man but as it moves hero. On,
yeah, as it moves on, it's quite interesting. So again, you know, Bond's at the old, they're showing about the mixture of gasoline and drugs with the triad people. Oh, and he's...
You're jumping ahead.
I'm a bad man. Go on, what have
again,
I done?
You're forgetting another brilliant scene.
Oh, yes.
His mustache and his broom.
His weird radio broom, yeah. Well, yeah. They're giving, to be fair, it's as what did Desmond Llewellyn say, it's the most fun he's ever had, because it's the most they've ever given him to do when he's getting to travel.
Because he's just... Because it's a scene of on the way to the compound, which doubles up as the televangelist's cult, which really worried me because I got massive Waco vibes.
That could be,
Which it could be intentional, it could not be, because it would have been in the news at that point. But Waco was 94, this was 89. But there's a lot of cults around that era.
There are.
There's Boko Asahara, who did the SARS attack on the Japanese train system. There's an Indian guru who set up a cult in, I think, Oregon and tried to run for, like, mayor and poisoned people with weaponized salmonella. So, it, you know, in the news, there were those kind of things. But yeah, just... Q and his disguises, and then being throwing it into the hedge as well afterwards, and walking off.
But it's also interesting. So again, you see and I'm glad you reminded me that, or I would have glossed over these. The fact that you see again Sanchez's, you know, sweep of power, because Pam's, you know, Pam tries to get a plane.
Yes.
And he's like, no,
it's her plane.
Senor Sanchez says, whatever
he's
must be done.
He's a full service.
Yeah, being stripped or whatever.
He's being dismantled. And she steals the crop duster that's just been left running handily just behind her over the shoulder in the shot.
Mm.
But yeah, I did like the... I also like the fact that Del Toro returns.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
For the final reveal. Because Del Toro recognizes Bond from the bar. But
yeah,
I
think he recognizes him even...
He recognizes him with the mask on.
Yeah, I was going to say his eyes. You must recognize his eyes, yeah.
What he does is, when they're doing the experiment, showing the triad how the petrol can be distilled back into what is essentially cocaine sludge, and then I'm guessing they'll dry it out, Del Toro has a knife in Bond's back.
Yeah, because he kind of says, who's the new guy, doesn't he?
Because Del Toro is questioning Sanchez, and it's like Sanchez, he's a useful man or something like that. And then obviously, whilst this is happening, Pam is flirting obnoxiously with the televangelist in his own
Professor Joe, played by Wayne Newton.
Yeah,
who does before really... Wayne Newton looked like a melted candle.
Yeah, and I think he does. I think he does a fun job.
Oh, I think he's very good in it. Yeah, I like him.
Yeah. And he takes her into his sex dungeon, as I like to call it, because it is. That's what that is. Come on,
soundproofed.
Yeah, soundproof sex dungeon. And she again, legs to die for, puts them to excellent use. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, as I say, Bond strikes in the science lab by headbutting Del Toro and then throwing a burning chemical, because they're explaining how the petrol is still petrol. So he ignites the petrol that's in the beaker. The Bond just picks it up and hurls it, and it starts in massive fire.
Well, they always say, don't they? They kind of make a joke about Dalton being the headbutting Bond, because he does it in Living Daylights and this one. But it's also, again,
one
a very
go-to
cool
moves.
Yeah, a very cool scene in the way they deal with him, which is he gets beaten up, but then gets basically his hands tied and put onto a conveyor belt to a, like,
yes,
a machine that's going to, you know, cut through the cocaine.
Yeah, it's a two cylindrical grinders that powder the cocaine. They just literally throw the blocks of cocaine in, and it just processes them. And it's the fact that Bond is still playing Sanchez.
Yeah, he is. Yeah.
At this point, he is still trying to point out things like, "What, well, you know, where's Hella?
Mm. Who's got your money?
Who's got your money?" Because again, they have a he has an external accountant, as it were. He has Truman a double barreled name. Yeah, Truman Lodge.
Truman Lodge.
Truman Lodge has got your money. Hella's got your missiles. You've got nothing. And it works.
Well, the only thing they get, because nothing gets his Sanchez's attention until the mention of Stinger missiles.
Yeah. And that's when Sanchez runs off and actually finds out Hella is. Because he gets caught.
Yes.
And Sanchez... Sorry, go on.
No, well, I was going to say, it's also... You're right. It cuts to the fact that he's dealing with Hella. But it's also going from that scene. So he finds him. And clearly, you know, things are going to get bad for Hella. But it's also the scene of where Dario is going to kill Bond, which is, you know, just a brilliant scene. And you know, Bond's hanging by.
He's clearly never seen a Bond film before.
No. But he's hanging on, isn't he? Because, like, he's been snagged.
Yeah, he's snagged with his own binds. But it's the fact that the building is still burning down. And Del Toro still commits the second worst thing a villain can do besides monologuing, which is moving in for the kill.
Mm.
And fun fact, he actually cut Timothy Dalton during that scene, and he still has the scars on his wrists.
Yeah, he did, yeah. I was about to say that myself, so you beat me too. He cut him.
Ah.
But it's very cool how Pam appears and tries... I don't really understand how she misses him. Or if she does shoot him and only, like, wings him. Because his response is, "You're dead." Because he's, like, kind of laughing. "You're dead." And she appears a bit heavenly in her robes that she's stolen.
Yes.
Because he obviously is supposed to think he's already killed her.
I can only think it is a distraction of, you know, it's almost like Emil in RoboCop.
Yes.
"You're dead. Yes. We killed you."
Yeah.
So it is that element of she misses him because she's expecting him to move. Therefore, mm-hmm. she's preempting his movement. But yeah, him getting thrown into the grinder. And the scene from below the grinder.
Oh, God, yeah.
But again, if you actually watch it, it's just blood. There's no chunks or anything like that.
Yeah.
So it's obvious that the grinder is not on the same set.
But and I do like the response from Bond, which almost has a, when you think about it, it's a slight almost comedy element when she's
switch
like,
"Switch the bloody okay? machine off."
Yeah, quite literally. But also a bloody machine.
Yes. Switch the bloody machine off.
And but it's like... and they then have to escape. But we do at least get the one Bond quip.
Yes. And it's really bad. So unfortunately, Hella has been impaled on the forks of a forklift, which then drives through the wall, which provides Bond and Pam with an exit because they are trapped. And Bond looks like Hella found a dead end.
Yeah.
And I was like, come on, Tim.
Yeah, I bet he said that one. I bet he was like rolling his eyes internally saying that.
Yeah, I'd have gone with something more like, "Well, I guess he forked up." Again, at least that makes sense. At least it's connected. It's still as bad, but it's
you'd really reuse the Thunderball line about you got the point.
Yeah, I think you got the point in that one. But yeah, so. I like how we're now into the final action scene and Pam robs the professor as they drive past in the golf cart. And he's just like, God bless you.
But it's, and then obviously they're in the plane and it comes to, because Sanchez, he's initially in the car, isn't he? In his Maserati.
In the Maserati by turbo.
I'm impressed, you know.
Yeah, well, I've been watching the Grand Tour recently, so. But yeah, he's in a very nice Maserati, and Bond and Pam drop onto the convoy. So it's four trailer tankers full of cocaine, petrol, and a couple of henchman cars. And Bond drops onto the last one. Sanchez apparently is an awful shot.
But he can play the James Bond theme with a bullet.
Yes, that was a lovely little touch. It's one of those things of the hidden Bond theme. Ding, ding, da-ding. So that was good. And then we get into the proper chases and, the glorious physical stunts.
Mm.
I mean, looking at the behind-the-scenes stuff for the tankers, I did start getting flashbacks to Fast and Furious going...
Or flash forward.
Yeah, it's like, I see where their influence comes from, but at least this is competent. And then...
It also shows that it sucks to be, Sanchez's accountant after he's...
Because
Truman loses his shit. He goes mad, does he? He's going, great, another $1 million write-off.
Yeah.
Whatever it is.
Yeah, he's like, we've lost so much because... At that point, Bond has destroyed one tanker via Stinger missile. So he runs it off the road initially. Yeah. And then one of the henchmen grabs one of the Stinger missiles, fires it at Bond, and the French stuntman who was on set did the almost unbelievable. Like, they genuinely didn't think this was even possible. He actually tilted the truck on two wheels. Wow. Originally, there was a truck. It's the last surviving truck as well. That truck was set up with a fifth wheel that was hidden in the sleeper bed. So from the way it's filmed, the underside of the truck would have been to the camera. So we see the underside, not the far side. So that an arm would have swung out and supported the truck at a 45-degree angle.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was they just run it along the rig with the extra stabilizer wheel, as it were. And they didn't need to. This guy just went, I can do it. And he just hits that. And it's, if you watch some of the behind the scenes featurettes, they're like, we didn't even think he could do it with just the cab. And he not only did he do it with the cab, he did it with the cab and the trailer. And then he dumps back on all four wheels on top of one of the henchmen's jeeps and flattens it.
The only really strange scene with that is that the henchmen waiting an awfully long time to fire the rocket off.
Well, I do agree in the sense of it is a long time, but it's also the fact of, if I remember my firearms correctly, the Stinger is... It's not a guided missile, but I think they're trying to make it sound like one.
Right.
So it needs time to lock onto a signature, which would make no sense as to why it then misses, as if it's flying like a standard missile.
Right.
But either way, it's for the purpose of a very, very beautiful stunt.
It's a very good stunt.
It's fantastic. It makes me smile every time. And then we get the slightly weirder stunt, which I tried looking up about this. There's not a lot of information on it, but Bond does a wheelie in a truck.
Yeah. I think that has to be an alteration to the vehicle to be able to do
it. Oh, absolutely. It's from my understanding, again, there's no photographs or anything like that. It's all hearsay, but the frame was cut in half. And there's a counterweight at the back of the truck, and the cab, the sleeper section of the cab at the back, was fitted with a hydraulic system. Mm-hmm. So the counterweight would hold the equivalent of the front end of the truck, and it would also be driven from the rear, because you never see the back of the truck until a cut shot. So as they're driving it through the flames, my understanding was all the controls were behind the truck. The cab mm-hmm. is empty, but the engine's still up there because you see the drive shafts turning.
Hmm. Interesting.
The other thing I've also seen as the option is it also looks like only the rear wheels are being driven out of the six wheels on the truck. So it could have also been that they set it up where it's essentially a car with front wheel drive with the front of a truck welded on it that's got nothing in it.
I could believe
like a bare bones truck. So that they lift the front end up, the back wheels, which are actually the front wheels of the former car, are then pushing it through. Like it will have been a custom built rig, but that one does get me a little bit because it's just like, I know trucks can't bend there, otherwise we'd have a lot more accidents. But it's also, Bond does a very Roger Moore thing.
Go on.
So as he's driving through this fire, he winds the window up. Which is very Roger Moore, that one, where he's just like cranking the window up as fire comes past him.
Maybe he's worried about his suit getting singed. But it's, I like the fact that obviously they take, you know, these machine guns at the window of the truck, which he then has to kick out. But I like the fact he uses cruise control effectively.
Yeah, I do and I don't on that sense, because you see it going off-road, but just trundling along, because it's important for the final scene.
Yeah, but obviously he uses it just
all the other ones
grab on to the other one, doesn't he?
Yeah, but all the other ones have been rolled over and exploded. But I do like how Bond dispatches one of the trailers as well. He when he does the two-wheeled stunt, as it were, mm-hmm. he's got the truck on its side. The trailer gets shot at and loses tires, and it jackknifes, and it's a long winding road, and the trucks are mm-hmm. below Bond. So he disconnects the trailer just at the right time.
That's true, yeah.
Which then hits one of the other tankers, which then that's why the accountant flips out, because he's like, right, we've lost three tankers now. We have one left. And Sanchez responds by riddling him with bullets.
Yeah, with a great line of cutting overhead. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. We got to start cutting overheads. Excellent suggestion. Brap!
It takes his bonds, isn't it? Yeah, bonds. He's got in his briefcase. But I like the fact that when it comes to the fight scene, because obviously Bond's now on the back of the tanker and he cuts the brake lines. He's fighting Sanchez, and Sanchez cuts the brake line, doesn't he? Because he goes in with his machete.
Well, Sanchez, the driver slams on the brakes. Bond falls between the tanker and the truck.
That's the one,
which is what triggers Sanchez. He gets out, goes ham with the machete, and cuts the airline. Now, unfortunately, again, a bit of a blooper. I only discovered this from researching the trucks. If you cut the brake line, if you cut the airline on a truck, it jams the brakes on.
I was just saying, does it lock up? Yeah.
It locks them up, not the other way around. So it's a little bit of a blooper, but again, it is a good little extra. It's a nice added danger to the final fight.
And it's Sanchez. One hell of a final fight, isn't it? Again, when I was talking about this change to brutal and almost realism.
Yes. Where they're
clinging on to the back of the petrol container section, fighting as it goes over the edge. And
that roll is because again, Bond opens the trailer. He takes the rear tap off. So it's dumping fuel as it's going. So even if he doesn't destroy it, the money's gone because it's all in.
Soaked fuel up in and coke going everywhere.
Soaked up, and the tanker rolls over. Really, it should be end credits at this point because no one's surviving that. But again, like you said, the added realism, Bond is crawling.
Oh, he's battered, yeah, and he's like groaning and
yeah, he's not in good shape. And somehow Sanchez, I think, fueled by anger and
Sanchez
adrenaline.
Comes out, but at that point, Sanchez looks the best. He doesn't look as battered. Bond's like soup shredded in parts. He's covered in blood. He's got nosebleed. He's like, ugh,
Sanchez, Sanchez is soaked.
That's true.
And then, of course, we get the fantastic Chekhov's gun ending of the lighter making a return and being the final weapon of getting the revenge of igniting Sanchez.
Well, it's the way Bond asks a pretty logical question, because the Sanchez obviously did think something of him, because he says to him, you know, you could have had everything. And he was worried about chop his head off, and he's saying, well, don't you want to know why? And that's how he sets him on fire. But it's an interesting point that Sanchez must have really thought something of Bond and thought he could have been his right-hand man.
Because at that point, Bond has shown no motivation.
Well, there's no logic. Can you imagine some guy's just on haywire and been offing people left, right, and centre? You're like, why is he doing this?
And it's not even the fact that Sanchez has a sudden awakening moment either of, you know, like a final realisation of, it was you all along.
Yeah, there is none of that.
There isn't one. No, he's just like, no, I'm not even going to give you the satisfaction. Flambe.
Yeah, I mean, do you think, I know we see an up close of the, you know, to Bond, to James, love Della and Felix, or Felix and Della on the lighter. Do you think Sanchez could see that, or do you think he just ignites him?
I think he just ignites him, because
yeah, I thought that. Yeah,
I also I'm also certain that's a reused shot.
It is. Yeah, yeah, it is.
It's the same shot from the wedding.
Yeah.
So I don't think Sanchez even gets the answer, which again would make sense for this. In the idea of Bond's motivation, he doesn't even give Sanchez the satisfaction.
And what, I mean, that...
Because it doesn't matter.
Yeah, that makes more sense. Yeah, when I first saw it when I was younger, I thought, well, he must see the lighter. I thought
he did, at least in a flash, but there's no way that Bond can hold it in such a way where he can still ignite it and Sanchez can read it. Now, if he had a second lighter...
Yeah, yeah.
...or a gadget, then we could have done that. He could have thrown him the lighter, let him read it as a distraction, and then hits him with another one.
No, I think you're right. He just sets him on fire. And it was, I think at the time, wasn't it like one of the longest burns he did or something for the guy who's in the costume? You know, the stuntman.
I don't think so, because I think that got beaten. Well, at the time it could have been, but I do know the two tanker explosions that look like Michael Bay's Wet Dreams. Those are real. Those are not miniatures. They are genuine tankers full of gasoline just blown up.
Because I know when they were blown, when they had the fire thing, I don't know if it was Timothy Dalton said it or they said about when they filmed it, he had to like really run away from stuff that was on fire.
Yeah, because there was an element of, it's a real highway. It's a real disused highway. Supposedly haunted.
Oh, the hand. Well. The hand. Yeah, the flaming hand.
Well, it's the fact that the road is actually supposed to be haunted in Mexico. A number of drivers have died. That's why they closed it off.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, again, a lot of practical effects. There's a fantastic shot of it looks like a flaming Jeep driving over off a cliff and over Pam's plane.
That's true. Yeah.
But I suspect perspective is a cameraman's best friend.
It's key. Yeah.
But again, it's a fantastic shot because it cuts to a close up of Pam like, oh shit. But again, Pam's crash landing is a bit, I find it a little bit funny. Like, she gets blowback from a Stinger missile from 3 feet away.
Yeah, because there's like, it blows a hole.
Sanchez uses the last,
doesn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, he uses the last Stinger missile, misses, but somehow damages the tail on the plane, which then crash lands into the desert and gets both of its wings hacked off as it flies through a little ravine. and then handily parks itself right next to Bond's truck that was on cruise control. So it's Pam true. Pam to the rescue at the end.
But I love that scene, as you said, when she goes to, she, you know, does the horn thing and says, like, you know, get in. But
aren't you going to ask me?
But it's that. But I'm telling you, May, for that scene there with the truck, the scene when you see Bond sat on the rock.
Yes,
I think that's really good because he looks tired. He looks beaten down.
Yeah.
Maybe wonder, is this it? Is this what
well, again,
it's over?
What do I do now?
Yeah. That's, yeah, shit. What do I do now?
Like, I've done what I set out to do. Now what?
Yeah, where and do then, I go?
Yeah, and then he goes back. Go on, sorry.
We can imagine him thinking, oh my God, my wallet's just gone up.
Oh God, yeah.
My Amex card.
I left the hotel key in the third truck. Shit. So yeah, it is not, as you say, it's nice to see that kind of experimental Bond that we now know as a standard.
Yeah.
Although I think now it's been pushed too far.
No, I'd agree. It is, because
like,
it has gone too far. But we do, for the first time, we kind of see Bond, he's resigned, he's battered, he looks human rather than this Teflon action hero. And it then cuts to, and people do complain about this, Bond, he's back at, well, what was Sanchez's place. And he's on the telephone to Felix and talking to him, and he's saying, you know, I'll come and see you. And he said, I think you might want to speak, you know, I think M might have a job for you. I think M wants, what's like, M wants to speak to you. I think might have
M
a job
might want to I think M wants to speak to you first.
Yeah. But he's saying, people complain saying that Felix seems too happy, but he's probably in a sense happy that at least he's alive and his friend's alive.
Yeah.
And there is a scene in the novelization where Bond says to him something on the lines of, I know it's difficult, but it, like, it gets better. He's obviously alluding to the loss of his wife.
Yeah, of course. He's going to, I have to admit, but again, I can, in my head, I can justify it with, he's probably off his noggin on drugs.
Yeah.
He's on the moon with painkillers. Because it's post-surgery, post-amputation.
Mm-hmm.
So I write off his joviality as it's the drugs.
Yes.
But it is a little jarring. And it should be like, it should be slightly somber. But, like, thank you, James.
Yeah.
It won't bring her back, but at least you know, at least we know it'll never happen to anyone else. You know, that would have been a better scene.
It does. It does go a bit, as I said, it's slightly improving the novelization with that. Well, there's like a comment upon that about the loss of his wife. And it's very interesting how we then see, obviously, Lupe is trying to get Bond to stay with her, the kiss, and then obviously Pam catches them. He's upset. Q again notices this. He's like, for God's sake, I think.
Yeah, because Pam hands Q his drink, her drink.
Yes.
So he's stuck with two drinks. Or is it? No, I think.
Well, he does. They have drinks. Bond hands his to you. Yeah, he's going, here's to you, my dear. And then they see it unfolding. And she runs off upset. But there's obviously the comment about the iguana, which was a pet of Sanchez's, which is hated by Lupe. But she said, you know.
Apparently on set, the lizard hated her.
Oh.
It never worked well on the scenes, but loved Robert.
Interesting. Well,
loved Sanchez as the actor.
Interesting. But it's she obviously gets what was the iguana's like necklace is now her diamond, you know.
Which to me made no sense because it's like, yeah, all that stuff's getting seized. This is a third world.
Well,
it's a third world back hole. There's going to be a power vacuum, and the next big drug lord is going to move in by just taking over the territory, including the house and everything in it.
But I do find it interesting how Lupe's trying to get Bond to stay with her, and he says, oh, I think you and El Presidente will make the perfect couple, and then
jumps off a wall.
Yeah. Somehow doesn't manage to like paralyze himself, but lands in the swimming pool.
I that would have been hilarious if there was no pool.
Oh my god!
He missed and landed on the patio with a shattered pelvis. Cue! Yeah. I need a wheelchair.
It'd be rather like, you know, that scene in, what was it, the cable guy, man down, possible back injury.
Yeah.
But yeah, he then pulls Pam into the water.
Yeah.
And they have the repeat of, you're going to, why don't you wait till he asked?
Yeah, it doesn't work for me, that. It's just like,
why don't you ask me? And the kiss.
Yeah.
The thing that is really weird, and I don't mind that too much as Andy, but why do we get the winking fish?
Because? I'm just assuming it's the implication of the cocaine has gotten into the water and now everyone's high. Why else would Bond vault over a wall into a swimming pool two stories below him?
But as the film goes, I didn't used to like it as much as I do now, and I've managed to reappraise it. And I think it's a good film, and I think it sets a good template for what would happen. But at the time, it wasn't a huge success, because I suspect it wasn't as, maybe a bit too realistic, maybe not as polished as people would want, you know, too violent.
I think the problem is it's too much too soon compared to The Living Daylights.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, The Living Daylights is a what you could call a more true-to-formula film.
Yeah, yeah.
So, again, it's got the jokes, it's got, as you say, the subverted violence. Everything's got a slightly more comedic twist, like even the car chase when, in The Living Daylights, Bond flies into the ski shed. And it's, you know, he's driving a shed round a... round a frozen pond, round a frozen lake, you know. So again, that's slightly humorous, the way he cuts the larder off at the wheels. Again, those elements are completely absent from this.
And
as I say, I think the huge cut in the budget can be seen in the fact that, again, we're not globetrotting around the world. There's only the final scene is the big blockbuster stunt, really, that and the opening. Mm-hmm. The middle is kind of like, it's mostly fist fights that end in escape.
Mm.
You know, with the exception of the water skiing onto the pontoon plane, but then the plane lands fine. Like, there's no real big set pieces kind of thing until the end with the trucks. So yeah, I think I agree with you. It's not an awful film. It's a good film. I can understand what they were aiming for, but it's certainly a sour note to finish on.
It is for him, yeah, definitely. What would you give it out of 10?
I'd probably say... I don't want to upset you, because I've enjoyed myself, and I don't want this to be my first and only celluloid. So you go first, and then I'll tell you.
Because
we've got a good one lined up for the next one.
I'll probably give it an 8, to be honest. 7 to an 8 out of 10.
I'm glad you went first, because I'm giving it a 5.
Ooh, well, nobody's fair enough. Give it whatever. I mean, people can give it whatever they want.
No, again, it's one of those things of, for me, I like the old Bonds where it's slightly campy, but I also understand that the older films do have their issues.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, rewatching them now, you do see them with, you know, the rose-tinted glasses do fall away slightly. And again, you compare this to Jason Bourne or any of the other more modern, slightly grittier spy films. I think it was just ahead of its time, and unfortunately, it just proves wrong place, wrong time.
And this for a film, for a film to end your tenure as Bond, it's a hell of a lot better than watching Die Another Day or No Time to Die, in my humble opinion.
I am in complete agreement with you. Die Another Day was a big letdown for me, as, again, Pierce Brosnan is my Bond.
Mm-hmm.
You know, GoldenEye is such a fantastic, like, that's a 9 out of 10 for me. GoldenEye is return to form, yet at the same time, fantastic villain, fantastic set pieces. Bond gets the shit beat out of him and shows it. And yet it still retains the charm of old Bond. Like, everyone's, you know, it had that glimmer of, you know, slight quippiness, but not so much. You know, Bond does a 360-degree spin in the tank and adjusts his tie before continuing the chase. I like that.
Yeah.
But as I say, I just think it probably would have done better as a standalone.
Mm.
But I mean, there's no way to really do that.
It could have been very different because I think they said, like, just on the wardrobe alone at one stage, they were trying to get Dalton to wear pastels, and he was like, no, Bond would not, you know, because it was Miami Vice style. So Bond, you know, wouldn't wear pastels.
Bond does not wear pink with a white suit.
No. Yeah, wouldn't happen.
It would have been a bit too Tony Montana for me as well.
Yeah.
Again, referencing Scarface, it's just a bit, it's out of character.
As a film, I think it does well, and it's an interesting comment that Dalton, when all the legal wranglings had been resolved and, you know, they came back to him and said, right, let's make another one. He basically said, well, we'll do one more, like, take all the good stuff from other two and make one more. And Broccoli was like, well, you can't do it that way. You've got to sign up to X amount. And he said, well, that's going to take me into whatever age you'd be, how much time of my life I'll pass.
Yeah, because how old was he when he made this?
Well, he was 41 when he made Living Daylight, so he'd be, what, 42, 43, maybe around that age?
Well, Living Daylights was 84, wasn't it?
87.
87. So,
yeah, and this was 89, so
he'd
be around, like, 42, 43.
Which, again, Pierce Brosnan went till he was, what, 55?
Something like that.
Die Another Day. So he wouldn't have been the oldest Bond.
No.
But I do understand his point of, you know, how long can I keep it up, kind of thing.
And it's also, I guess, a big chunk of your life. And if you want to do other things, you know, because the time when everything was getting ready for the next Bond, he was playing Rhett Butler. So he was doing the Scarlet thing. So obviously you want to try other stuff. So, but again, it's like there's a book that's come out talking about the potential for the other films that could have come afterwards, and I'm kind of grateful in a sense we only got the two, because it's a bit like, I always feel that if they've made you the what if can be a lot worse than the, well, we haven't got it, the reality. Well, you know, it's better to just have
it's better to have the idea than see it ruined
in the reality. Yeah,
otherwise you end up with a No Time to Die.
Yeah. And on that bombshell, I think we've definitely been talking enough solo Codswallop, because Gemma will kill us on the length of time this is, so I think this could end up being a twofer.
Well, I'm sorry, but the film is 2 hours and 15 minutes, and we've only gone 2.5, you know, nearly, right, we've only gone 45 minutes over. I think that's appropriate.
Yeah, I
it's
agree.
It's a long film.
I agree, Gem Hulk, you know, the anger.
I know, but still, well, if she says anything... Next week, we'll be doing Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Ring, the Blu-ray edition, which is 4 hours long.
Yeah, so it's like we're going to do 10 hours.
Easy.
With two hours of Car Corner tagged on the end.
Yeah, because, you know, there's that truck that goes past in the wide shot.
Well, it has been a pleasure, James. I'm very, very
glad. Always is, my friend. Always is.
That you discussed this. So, as I said, we've been talking of Solo Codswallop. I've been James.
I've also been James.
Thank you for listening, everybody. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening, guys. Bye.